former Chicago musician Nico Case, Chicago Tribune food reporter Louisa Chu, and the Bears Camp Report with Adam Hoge. And now, here's your host, a man who is still clinging to his Olympic dreams, Justin Kaufman.
It's that shoulder injury, man. Or I'd be swimming right now. To doing the fly stroke. Right? I was a troublemaker swimmer. Coach was like, you got so much talent, but you just don't follow the rules. You know, I'd like wear a different colored Speedo, you know, a leather jacket with no shirt, you know, like Ray-Ban goggles. I was a black sheep, and they just couldn't handle it. You know, it's like one of those things where I probably would won like 35 gold medals. And, you know, I just decided at an early age, like 10 years old, and I'm like, you know what? I don't need this. And I gave it up. So around this time of year when the Olympics start back up, you know, I get a feel like what could have been. You know, I'm you know, I digress. Welcome to the download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Wow, Michigan Avenue is jumping tonight. Lots of people out and about on a beautiful night in downtown Chicago. We're glad to be a part of it. We're also glad to be a part of your broadcast night, whether you're getting home from work, ready to start the weekend, or starting your shift, or maybe you're in the car getting away. We got you tonight here on the download. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. Nico Case. Nico Case is here. How great is that? Nico Case, of course, the longtime member of the New Pornographers. She was obviously has had a tremendous success with her solo career. She's collaborated with so many different artists, including Kelly Hogan, who we had on the show. And she is now part of Case Lang Veers, which is the new supergroup. Katie Lang, Laura Veers, Nico Case. And they're going to be at Chicago Theater on Sunday night. And Nico Case is going to talk with us tonight about her time in Chicago and also this collaboration. It's really great to have her on. We've been trying to get her on the show for probably a year. I feel like she was one of the early guests that were like, we have to have Nico
Case. Yeah.
She's great. I love her music.
I remember I saw, this is early on. She may have had released her first record on Bloodshot, and I was at Metro seeing a show.
As you do.
I can't remember who I was seeing, but she was in the audience. She was standing pretty much right next to me by herself, kind of in that back area, like near the bar.
Yeah, right.
And I kept on staring at her for, I don't know, an hour.
What was your line? What'd you say?
Is your name Nico? Is exactly what I exactly
she's like,
what
buzz
I said.
Off. Did she say yeah?
She said yes, and I said, I like your stuff, and then I like, you know, shimmied away because I got nervous. Yeah.
Can I buy you a Miller Genuine Draft for $9 at the bar?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good story. I'll
tell her that when I get her on the line.
Yeah, you should. Is your name Nico?
Got some game.
She's like, this guy again. Yeah, okay. Nico Case coming up at 8 o'clock. Also tonight, we're going to have to talk about the police shooting. The videos released by IPRA. The Chicago Tribune just put out a piece that essentially, great, great piece, just sort of breaking down the videos, some of their crime reporters, and talking about the procedural errors. You know, we want to jump to conclusions and we want to rush to judgment, and that's what a lot of people really have been pushing for today. And that's not going to happen. But I do think that they're, you know, when you put out, I think that's what's going to happen and what the value is in putting out police shootings to the public is you get the opportunity for people to at least look at the procedural, the way that police went about their business and make sure that everything is on the up and up. And in this case, primarily it was, but there are some things that they pointed out that didn't pass muster. We'll talk about that coming up here after 7:30. Marco Johnson is going to join us, former police officer, 29 years on the force, retired. We'll talk to him about what he saw on the video. I enjoy that, like having police officers be able to see that, not just what happened in the rush, the minute and a half that, or you know, at the 1:12 moment in the video where it was all happened so fast, but to talk about the before and the after and how it all went down there, too. Really tough story, and we'll talk about it tonight. Also, the Olympics tonight. Are you going to watch? I think we should just turn it on. And what channel of the Olympics? Channel 5?
Yeah.
We should just turn it on and just do Mystery Science Theater to it.
Love to.
For like 3 hours tonight.
Feel like it's been, say, 4 years since I heard of Michael Phelps and how much he eats story.
I did not know this. Jeff Carlin was telling me that Michael Phelps had his pot DUI. I think it was the pot DUI and some other stories since the last Olympics. I didn't know that. I thought it was before the last Olympics. So he hasn't done an Olympic swim since all the off the. Would you say off the rink? What do you say off the pool?
Out of the pool.
Out of the off. He's great on the pool. Off the pool. Thousands of athletes, hundreds of thousands of hours of work for American audiences to go, meh. That sums up the Olympics, right? And it's interesting it's starting now, but I have to say, like, I'm really trying to instill some patriotism in my 9-year-old son.
Yeah.
He doesn't really, this would be really his first sort of tangible and sort of, what would you say?
He understands
lucid.
What's
yeah.
going on.
Because,
yeah.
you know, the last one, he would have been 5. Yeah. He doesn't care, right? So now I'm like trying, he's not a big sports kid. So, you know, I'm trying to explain to him, it's not really about the sports. It's about your country against other countries.
Yeah.
And that's what he said. He's like, oh, okay. So like we swim against China. And he's like, oh, we're going to beat China. And I'm like, yeah, exactly.
Nice.
And I'm like, but we're not going to, I don't know when it's on. It's probably opposite one of your cartoons, so don't get too excited. But it was funny because I was trying to get my wife to have him watch the opening ceremony because we're on tonight and he's at home. And I'm like, hey, you know what? If you could do this, if you could, you know, watch it. She's like, nah, I'm not that interested. And I'm like, well, I'm interested and I want my son to be into it. Can you show? She's like, and she made a good point. She's like, well, it'd be like me. Or her saying to me, I'm really into fashion. Can you watch the fashion show with him? And I'd be like, eh. So she's really not into the Olympics. But I think that's wrong. I think
yeah.
this is the fun part is like this weird kind of Olympic sort of opening night, right?
I love the Olympics. I'm a fan of the Olympics. And I know there's, you know, the real sports piece about, you know, how terrible it is and what it does to the cities and stuff. And I just kind of look past that for now and enjoy the spectacle. And, yeah, I always like the, you know, the opening ceremonies yeah. are exciting.
I mean, we were kids. I mean, I feel like I'm 41 years old, and I feel like maybe the Olympics in Seoul, maybe the Olympics before that, I'm thinking like 88, 92,
yep.
whenever that was, when Greg Louganis, it was like something, he hit his head on the back of the diving board, or Carl Lewis.
Right.
Remember Carl Lewis had a singing career after he was track and field?
Didn't he sing Super the national hilarious. Anthem?
It's really bad.
Bad, yeah.
But he had like an awesome video that we found one time that was like almost like a workout video where he was singing the song and working out in the gym, like doing curls. And then it would cut in like some footage of running. You know, running on a track, but it was outstanding.
I gotta look for that.
It was early internet. I remember it was almost like a little Easter egg. You found, like, if you clicked on about Carl Lewis, you got this video, and you're like, this is the best video I've ever seen in my life. So I'm a huge Carl Lewis fan. Now. I was as a kid too. What was the kid? Was it Ben Johnson, the guy who was doping from Canada?
I think that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. There's Flojo. Well, Flojo, right?
Yeah. I mean, who's the guy from Jamaica? Who's the fastest guy?
Bolt.
Yeah, Usain Bolt.
Is he in the Olympics this year? See, that's the thing. I don't know when they're, like, I don't know who on the gymnastics team is. Is it the same women from the last time? I mean, I feel like it's the thing, like, 4 years and you're pretty much now an adult and you got to get a job. Like, you're out. They were all 16 and 17 years old, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, Michael Phelps, you know, has been doing it, but, you know, gymnasts, I think their careers are over. When we talked to the woman from who's in Cirque, who was a gymnast, you know, she said, like, after you're 16, pretty much you're done.
I would think the Americans, it would be maybe be a good sketch, or it'd just be awesome if they could put it together. So there's like a 44-year-old gymnast who was just like, oh, like on the sideline, like
waiting to get in, waiting for a shot.
Waiting like an alternate. Always on the side, like, come on, let's do this.
Maybe it could be like a Rudy type thing,
yeah,
where
right.
he or she finally gets into the Olympics.
She's a freak of nature, and she always makes a team, but she never makes like the top five. This is a script work Pete and I are working on.
Yeah. Don't
It's called The Olympian. It's called The Olympian, and it stars Will Ferrell as a woman, and she is the seventh.
It's like we're printing money.
We're printing money. So all you producers, Hollywood producers, listen out there. It's already done. We already sent it to the Library of Congress. So don't even try steal it. But if you want to work with us and give us some money, some development deal, Pete and I are available.
I think if you watch the Olympics one day, you know everything. You know, you'll find out who the gymnasts are. You'll find out who the swimmers are.
That's going to be hard for us because we're always on the air, so we're going to miss all those feel-good John Tesh stories. Where they're like, let's peek in on the Chinese pole vaulter. She grew up, Leng Sing Sao grew up in the rural area. Like, we'll miss all that.
Yeah.
You know, that's the best part of the Olympics. Is John Tesh back? He better be back.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Bob Costas.
Oh, you know it.
He's probably doing tonight. I'm telling you, we should have programmed, instead of counter-programming the Olympics, we should have just played the Olympic opening ceremony and just talked about the Olympics for 4 hours.
Next year,
4 years from now. All right. Lots to do tonight. Also coming up, Adam Hoag's going to join us, talk about Bears camp. But I'm very excited about this. Jack Silverstein's coming back tonight as we start our year-long celebration of the 10-year anniversary of the 2006-2007 Chicago Bears. My favorite. Everyone will say the 85 Bears is the best team they ever played. And that's true. But the 2006 Bears with Brian Urlacher, Lance Briggs, Ottawa Lagunlia, Mike Brown, the safeties, the corners, Charles Tillman, that was such a good team. That defense was unbelievable, fast. They seemed to just run to the ball. Thomas Jones on the other side, Mohsin Mohamed, talk about that Bears team and how they went to the Super Bowl. Just so close. And it's really been the only other team of glory that the Chicago Bears have had besides, what, 63, 85, and 2006.
Yeah.
So it's a 10-year anniversary of that team, so we'll try to, this year we're going to try to get some of those players in.
Love it.
Talk about, what were some of the turning points that season. We'll start tonight with Jack Silverstein. Also, Louisa Chu is going to be here from Chicago Tribune. We're going to talk with her about some dining news. This is an interesting kind of thought, dust-up. About whether or not restaurants should charge you if you ditch out on your reservation. That's how tight the margins are at some smaller restaurants in town. They get these nice reviews. People want to come out. People go, oh, I got to get those, to, you know, and then they don't show up for the reservation. And some chefs in Chicago are saying, I'm losing money. I had to turn people away. You know, you're not showing up. That table's empty. I need that money to survive. So we'll talk to Louisa Chu about how real that is, and if that really is a consideration for restaurants in Chicago and the area, that will be adapted, that if you make a reservation, they'll take your credit card, and if you don't show up, they're charging you. Almost like the dentist. You know, if you don't do it within a certain amount of hours, boom, you're paying for a bottle of Chianti, whether you like it or not.
I find where these, I should not exclude the hot, restaurants on the, eater hot list, like Stephanie Izard's Duck Goat.
Right.
You go to Open Table and you want to get a reservation, but you can't get one. It's impossible. So I go January 2017. Let's see what I can find.
And then you forget about it.
And then you forget about it.
Not even forget about it. You just get to a point where you're like, well, I'm not going to dinner this week. You know what? I got other stuff going on. It's my mom's birthday. What do you want me to do?
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, should you be charged if you have to change your mind? It's a good conversation. We'll have it coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. So a lot to do tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr. Production provided by Rob Zim, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get this show on the road. It's The Download. It's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. And we start with the carryout, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, You don't have to. Here are today's top stories. IPRA released video of the shooting of 18-year-old Paul O'Neill. It's from several body cameras of officers involved in the South Shore incident. You can see the video on WGNradio.com. Protesters stormed a police press conference today, and several IPRA critics are blasting the review authority for showing the video at all. Although the decision is getting high marks from reformers just based on the immediate release as opposed to 300-plus days. The lawyer of the O'Neill family questions the video released and believes there's more to be seen. Of course, the officer who shot O'Neill, his body camera was not working. A protest is being scheduled for Sunday afternoon, Millennium Park. If this case shows anything, it shows that not every police shooting is black and white. Not every police officer is corrupt, and not every criminal deserves to die. Today is a gray day in Chicago. CPS laid off 1,000 staff today, including 500 teachers. A CPS spokesperson says this is normal and that the 500 teachers can reapply for open positions. And you wonder why nobody wants to be a teacher. Normal? Gee, every summer you're fired? That's normal? The teachers union said this is bad practice and hurts students. Normal. Maybe if I say the word normal enough, we'll lose the meaning. Normal, 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 normal. Jeez, a new jobs report says that the country is in recovery. What's it mean? Well, it depends on which blog you read. If you bookmark Mother Jones, Obama's the best president ever. If you look at Breitbart, Obama's a Muslim, so take your pick. This is interesting. The country's one step closer to using genetically modified mosquitoes to take on the Zika virus. Something tells me this is going to backfire. The Zika mosquitoes will convince the robot mosquitoes to turn on us. It's going to be Mosquito Braveheart. You just watch. Right out of a science fiction storyline, the melting ice in Greenland may expose a once-buried military base with a possible nuclear reactor. Either this is global warming or the next sequel for Austin Powers. Hey, it's melting, baby. Yeah. There you are. Looking for you. Yeah, baby. Cheeky, baby. Great America. I've been waiting to do my Austin Powers. It's something that I've had. I have that on my resume, so when I get rehired as a teacher, I've got that as one of my skill sets. Great America is going to test out a new nationwide feature on the Demon roller coaster next weekend. Virtual reality. Yep, you wear virtual reality goggles while riding the roller coaster. Where are we as a people where a roller coaster is just not enough of a thrill ride? Like, throw some virtual reality on a pontoon boat. You know, there I see how virtual reality can work. But a roller coaster? I'm worried. I'm worried about us. Jeez. A decision was delayed on whether the Wicker Park nightclub, The Double Door, will be closed. They're being evicted by the landlord, who really wants to give the neighborhood what it deserves, another bank. So this decision means you have more time to not go to The Double Door. I love Double Door. Haven't been there in years. In weather, it's hot, but I think it's going to be okay this weekend, I think. Again, I don't look at forecasts. I just feel it. I feel it in my bones. In sports, the Bears injury report continues to roll as Kevin White was given the day off. Okay. And a backup tight end was hospitalized with a bruised lung. It's practice, guys. Maybe he fell on the football. Remember when you were a kid and you'd fall on the football? Ugh. In baseball, the Cubs are in Oakland tonight. John Lester takes the mound. The White Sox host the Orioles. Jose Abreu hit a home run last night. Actually, the first in 33 games. Jeez, there you go. If you're looking for why the White Sox aren't so good. The Olympics start tonight, so get ready for a month of semi-appointment TV. Yeah, I guess I'll watch this. Assuming that Rio is ready to roll, it'll be fun to watch how the U.S. team does in swimming, gymnastics, and basketball. Indoor volleyball, though, man, that's my jam. They have a strong shot to do very well in the games with someone saying that they could be the top medal collector. They could take those medals and barter for Evian and bug spray. So it works out. I feel bad for, like, the Portuguese. No medals, you just go straight to the hospital. You're just out. You got to drink straight from the sewer. And finally tonight, the DC comic movie Suicide Squad is in theaters, and it's likely to win the weekend despite pretty bad reviews. I could have told you this was going to happen. Sorry, but no Will Smith movie does well without a Will Smith rap on the soundtrack. A Suicide Squad. We'll bring you to a Suicide Squad. We're going to go downtown. You know it's true, right? It's a big mistake. You got to have a Will Smith rap. That's the carryout for August 5th, 2016. It's Friday, so we got a special pizza for the Olympics. Who doesn't love Brazilian mosquito pizza? Mmm. Ow. Mmm. Ow. should just do a whole segment on Will Smith soundtrack songs.
We're going to the Suicide Squad. Come on, we're going to the Suicide Squad.
Look it up. The only movies that work for Will Smith are ones he does a soundtrack for. All right, coming up, more 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, coming up after the news, we'll talk about the big police shooting video. Marco Johnson is going to join us, a former Chicago police officer, retired 29 years. We'll talk about what he saw in the video. Rob Martier, how are you? What are you thinking about this weekend? You got some big plans?
I'm thinking about tomorrow morning, my 16-year-old twin boys and I, who you saw up here on the seventh floor, we're going to be leaving for Pittsburgh to go visit my mom for a week. It'll be fun.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, Pittsburgh's a good town.
Do you push the Olympics on the kids?
No, some of it. I'm a big fan, like most, of the swimming. That always gets me going. Mm-hmm. And some of the track and field stuff. If they want to watch, yeah, that's fine.
But I feel like I'm going to be that dad who just pushes it. I push the Olympics. Like 2 hours, 2 hour, 2 hour diet of Olympics every day. I don't care what you got to watch this whole opening ceremonies. I know it's goofy. I know it's surreal. I know it's abstract. Watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, I try to get myself into, you know, especially like the track and field, because it's important. Oh, and so they embrace it big time in Europe, but you know, it's not so much here.
I know, and the sports that we do embrace, like basketball, it's okay. What's the point of watching?
I'll tell you why don't you just play the silver and bronze games now?
Right.
You know, just give Team USA the gold.
It's so obnoxious.
I mean, it's not even going to be close.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we're going to talk with Nico Case, who's going to be at the Chicago Theater on Sunday. It's part of Case Lang Veers, the super group with Katie Lang and Laura Veers. That'll be Sunday. It's a new project, new record that's out. We'll talk with her about that and also about her time in Chicago. She spent a considerable amount of her career here in town. Obviously, she's had such success as a solo performer, but also as a member of New Pornographers. So we'll talk with Nico Case coming up at 8 o'clock. Today, the Independent Police Review Authority released several body camera videos from the shooting of 18-year-old Paul O'Neill. This incident happened on July 28th, and the autopsy revealed he was shot in the back. He was behind the wheel of an alleged stolen vehicle, and police fired upon the vehicle when it sped past a police SUV and a standing officer. The video shows the officer firing on the car and the suspect fleeing on foot with officers in pursuit. The actual shooting is heard off camera as the body camera of that officer was not working. What does the video show us, and what should Chicagoans make of it? Is it a clear-cut example of police misconduct, or at least procedural error, or an example of police officers taking appropriate action when they feel like their lives are in danger? Joining me tonight is a retired Chicago police officer, Marco Johnson. Johnson worked for the police force for 29 years. Now he runs a sports camp and youth program for at-risk kids with the mission of giving positive alternatives to drugs and gang life. Mr. Johnson, thanks for joining us.
No problem. How you doing, Justin?
I'm good. So why don't we start here? When you saw the videos, what was your first reaction?
As a police officer, my first reaction was that... what did he see prior to shooting that gun? And from what I saw in the video, the cop was up on him. So my first reaction was that was pretty close to borderline in terms of he should have held off on shooting. But again, you can't Monday morning quarterback on that. We wasn't there, so I don't know what he was feeling.
I think for everyone, Chicagoans, I mean, this idea of being able to see through the eyes of the body camera is something brand new. I mean, this is something to see this. I mean, it's very hard to understand what we're seeing, what's happening. The Chicago Tribune put out a nice piece with the crime reporters kind of breaking down what they call procedural error. When you see this kind of stuff, is that what we're looking for? Are we looking for when police officers aren't following the law of the police?
I think the body cameras were instilled to give the community a sense of trust in the police department. But I think that the body cameras is not effective for a police officer to wear, because it inhibits his ability to react to situations, and it holds him back. I'm not a fan of the body cam, but it seems like a necessary evil nowadays, because we're getting a lot of overreaction in situations that I've seen across the country.
You know, in this situation, and trying to make sense of it in conversations in the office and even conversations on WGN radio or all day about this, you know, it's interesting because you're trying to, I mean, obviously what people want to see is whether or not this was a justified shooting. And you don't get to see it in the video. What you get to see is a lot of police procedure that I've never been privy to. When we see that kind of stuff, and you as a police officer who's been in that situation, what should we be looking for?
A lot of times you should look at a situation in terms of what happened prior to what you see on camera. You can't see that. So you have to take the police officer's word. So what you see on camera a lot of times is not the whole story. But then, you know, there's a couple of instances like the Laquan McDonald situation. That was overkill, in my opinion. Then you had other situations, I think, in New York where the guy was bombarded. We're taught certain things in the police academy, and the main thing we're taught in the use of force is to protect self and to protect the community. So we should be looking on the outside looking in. We should be looking, is this officer protecting himself and the community, or is he overextending and over abusing his authority? You can kind of, you know, and even in the videos you guys seen today, you can kind of see some reactions that you may disagree with or you may agree with. Everybody's going to have a different opinion, especially if the person that's given the opinion doesn't like the police, or the person that's given the opinion think that the community of African-American or Hispanics are just all thugs. So, you have to get an objective opinion.
You know, I mean, we're talking with Marco Johnson. He's a former Chicago police officer, talking about the videos that were released today and the shooting of Paul O'Neill. I'm interested in just that. I mean, protesters kind of broke up the press conference of Superintendent Johnson today. You know, they seem to be upset. They speak to a larger no justice, no peace concept of, and what they're going to march on Sunday is not necessarily about the idea of this particular incident, but this idea that their relationship with the police, they continue to be in situations where it may not be a life or death situation, but they're ending up on the death side. How do you respond to that?
There's no perfect entity. But if you look at statistics, the police departments across the country have done a great job of policing the communities. There's always bad seeds in every organization. So it's magnified when a man of law with a badge on is doing something that he shouldn't be doing, and it becomes triple what the normal man does. Because, I mean, look, we're killing each other at an alarming rate, but they're not marching on gangbangers. They're not marching on the community at large when the murder rate, when you look at it, is over 70% of black young kids are being killed by another black man. I just think that the police department has to be more aware of who they're allowing to police our community. I think the police department needs to look like the community that they're polices. I think there's a miscommunication in there. I'm not saying that all the police officers have to be all black in the black community, but there's a large discrepancy in the police looking like his community. And I think by not understanding who you're policing, a lot of times you take a stereotype and you use it doing your job, and it could cause an overreaction, and that's how I feel about that. So,
Margaret, when you saw today, I mean, what I was fascinated as a citizen of Chicago was the stuff we saw on video, the procedure after the fact. Not necessarily the chase and the shooting that you didn't actually see, but the procedure of the officers being sort of rounded up, the stories being told. That's something that the public never gets to see. I mean, when you saw that, that seemed to be something that I mean, from my vantage point, and again, I'm inexperienced, and it seemed to be on the up and up. That seemed to be following protocol.
Right, absolutely, and they have to, for the most part, the police officers are doing what they're supposed to do. And they're covering all their bases. I think that policemen take the job and the ones that's taking it are really legitimately trying to help in the community. Mm-hmm. So what we saw today was police officers trying to do their job, dot their I's and cross their T's. Even if there was a mistake made, you try to follow the right procedure in closing out that particular case. I'm not saying what happened today was correct. Like I said, I thought it was borderline in terms of the shooting. You know, especially
shooting on the car, things of that nature.
Yeah, especially to continue to shoot after the car was passed them. It was no longer a threat to you. Right. I just thought that, you know, it was kind of careless because you didn't know. And I know the officers wasn't looking around to see who was on the other side of the street in the direction he was shooting, because he just started shooting. So I thought that was kind of careless in that situation.
For you, I mean,
again, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, for you, I mean, you spent 29 years on the force. How many situations, I mean, can you recount where you were in situations where you had to make split decisions, not necessarily with firing your weapon, but the idea of having to sort of just go with your instinct or your training as opposed to getting a second opinion or being able to do things exactly by the book?
It was countless times that, I mean, we've had guns pulled on us. We've had police shooting at us thinking that we were part of the community when we were undercover. We've had a lot of situations where we've had multiple occupants in the car. We've had situations where we've had people charge us and want to fight regardless of who we were. So there was countless situations that we had to make split decisions and make good decisions. And I think a lot of that making good decisions come with experience, but it also takes a lot of knowing who and what's going on in your community. As a police officer, you got to know the community. It's almost as if you have to live there and be a part of it. So
that's an interesting concept, especially when you think about, I mean, the idea, what I'd ask is about respect. I mean, you see in this situation, police everywhere as this, this alleged, you know, carjacker essentially just brazenly goes through a police roadblock. He almost hits a police officer. You know, he's not doing anything in the case to show respect for the fact that police have essentially have him cornered. When you think about it, and you're a retired officer, but when you think about the relationship between the community and not only the community, but just the relationship between police and perpetrators, has it changed over the years? I mean, I know you're retired, so you're not on the force right now, but is that part of the problem, that there really isn't that sort of that respect and communication?
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in a housing project, so we dealt with the police on a daily basis as kids growing up. The one thing that we had was the utmost respect for law enforcement. If they told us to move, we move. We didn't always do it willingly, in terms of we gave them some lip, but we were moving while we were giving the officer lip. Respect is lost between the police and the community, and it's kind of, you kind of have to blame both sides. I think a lot had to do with the CAPS program being implemented and then allowing the community to have a bigger say in how we police. I think the policing of the streets of any major city, of any large group of people, sometimes is not going to be liked, but is necessary.
That's interesting, yeah. So, yeah, so less by committee is what you mean. It's
right.
Like when CAPS would the community started to learn to even tell police while they were doing their job if they felt they were doing it wrong, right?
Absolutely. And we were constantly being badgered. You know, a lot of police officers took that to heart and they just backed off, being aggressive, being the man on the streets. Intimidation is very important in terms of manhandling that street when the streets are very high crime profile areas, as opposed to how I police the area of Beverly, which is a nicer area and more calm than the way I would police an area that's high crime. It changes. You have to adjust to the environment. And then even within an environment of high crime, you have kids that are great kids, and you have to adjust to even that. When the community comes in and say, officer, you should have done it this way, and you should, with no training at all and just from the naked eye, and you're filming me doing my job at the end, you're filming me when I have to strike a guy to the head to knock him off his balance so I can cuff him. Well, the citizens see me doing my job as I was trained to do, but in their opinion, we're beating on the guy.
Do you think at all? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about that word training. Do you think, I mean, you said it just perfectly in the way that that's, you're trained to do that. You have to subdue someone who needs to be cuffed. You just the training that you need to protect yourself and protect the community. Is there something in here as we move forward and we continue to see the landscape, the environment change, that the training has to change?
And I think you're absolutely right. There has to be some adjustments on both sides. I think that with the police department, we definitely have to change some things, especially, in my opinion, the sensitivity aspect of our training. But at the same token, the community policing concept and the community at large has to be more open to the aggressive nature of a police officer and how he has to or she has to do her job in order to gain control of certain situations. I don't say that the police officer has a right to kill, steal, maim, or none of that. But sometimes our job calls for us to take control of the situation in an aggressive manner that may cause me to strike the individual, or that may cause me to do something that the community who's not trained would not agree with.
Marco Johnson is a former Chicago police officer, retired. He's on the police force for 29 years. He now runs a sports camp and a youth program for at-risk kids. I want to thank you for joining us, and let's continue the conversation.
Oh, no problem.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So download here on WGN Radio. It's good to talk to Marco Johnson. That was good. Interesting. About training, but also about some of the tactics that need to be used. And most importantly, and I think a lot of people who are police officers, families of police officers, or just supporters of police officers, that's always been the point of contention when it comes to body cameras, is what happened before and what happened after. Not everything and not every piece of information is delivered on a body camera. So you may get an officer like Marco Johnson, you know, subduing somebody, and right away you're like, oh, look at this guy. But you don't know where that came from. And it goes even further back. It goes to a point where, you know, you don't know a lot about the relationship of the police officer in the community. And to his credit, he also said that needs to be improved. If you have police officers who are embedded in communities, you might know that kid. You know what I mean? There may be something where it's a little bit more, it's less about just, you know, the exact, the sort of fear and the things that are happening in the moment, and more about the relationships that have happened before that. So anyway, coming up, also real quick programming note, no frying pan tonight. Forgot to mention that at the beginning. Steve Gadlin out of town. He's actually on a plane right now. I brokered, I was negotiating, bartering, pleading for him to be on, but he is actually in the air right now. I told him they have airplane phones. He can't do tonight, so he'll be back next week. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is playing Chicago Theater this Sunday night as part of the supergroup Case Lang Veers. I'm trio of music superstars, Nico Case, Katie Lang, and Laura Vera spent 2.5 years working on this music. Nico Case, of course, is no stranger to Chicago. The indie rock sensation spent years here in town working with Kelly Hogan, Robbie Foulkes, and, well, I'm not sure why I'm naming Chicago musicians specifically because she's pretty much worked with them all. Nico Case is Chicago music royalty, and it is my pleasure to welcome her to The Download. Nico Case, thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's talk about this collaboration. This is a big show at the Chicago Theater on Sunday. How did this come about?
Well, I had met Katie in Portland for a tandem interview, and we just hit it off and became friends, and she had just moved to Portland, and so I told her she should really look up Laura Veers and Tucker Martine, because they're great people and musicians and have stuff in common. And so, you know, we kind of knew each other that way, just kind of as acquaintances. And then Katie sent both Laura and I an email and said, let's make a record. And Laura and I replied probably faster than anyone has ever replied to anything ever, like, yes, we would love to do that.
What did you know of Katie's music at the time? Obviously, everyone knows it, but, I mean, were you a big fan of her? I mean, when you...
I was a huge fan, and I had spent a lot of years living in Canada because I went to school there, and, you know, Katie was very prevalent in the United States, obviously, but in Canada, she's revered as a national treasure, as she should be. Like, she's on a postage stamp, for crying out loud. But, you know, I just was such a huge fan because she managed to do all these things that I learned about. And, you know, she did them in her own style and went straight to the front of the line based on her talent. Like, she is that talented and has definitely the strongest voice I've ever stood next to anywhere. And so there was just so much to emulate there when I was younger. And then there was just so much to be inspired by. And obviously, the raw talent of her singing and the sound of her voice speaks for itself. Like, that's enough right there. But then the way she went about everything and, you know, coming from rural Alberta and just being a kind, nice person, you know, there's just so much to look up to.
It's one thing to look up to somebody and want to emulate their music, but it's another to work with them. Talk about the chemistry of putting together the music when you guys got in studio and started playing together.
Well, we didn't get into the studio together until, I don't know, probably about 2.5 years into actually working
really?
On the project.
Okay.
Because we thought at first maybe we'll make a covers record, and then we thought, well, no, let's make kind of a punk rock girl group record. And then when we started, you know, because as a collaboration, a lot of people get together and they will bring original songs, but they don't necessarily write them together. So we decided that we would make it extra hard and try to write them from the ground up.
Wow.
Which was, you know, really hard, but we all were into the nerdery of that idea. So we went with it.
Right.
And it's really funny. Katie actually reminded us the other day, like, basically we were over 2 years in, and one day in her apartment realized we had never really sung three-part harmony together. All the songs together. And we were like, yeah, we should probably see if this actually works out. And then I think we started working on I Just Want to Be Here With You.
Mm-hmm.
It was either that or Best Kept Secret, and we were like, okay, it's going to be fine. We're going to be fine.
The record's great, and the music, I mean, there really isn't a lead. I mean, you guys sort of trade off, but the harmonies, I mean, there really does feel to be almost in the spirit of true collaboration with the three of you coming together on this.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't want to make it, you know, a record where where we sang three-part harmony throughout, because we wanted the songs to dictate what we did, and as my friend Kelly Hogan always says, you know, serve the songs, which is exactly what we wanted to do. So we tried to just kind of go with what felt like should be there or was the most musical for that part, which sounds like huge umbrella of description in the word musical, because it is hard to pinpoint exactly what it is when a song is telling you what to do, because it's your insides telling you what to do, and it was consensus, and it was a lot of work, and it was, you know, a democratic process as well. So there was a lot going on.
Well, you talked a little bit about the collaborative process of all of you deciding to do it from the ground up, the nerdery of it. But I'm interested in how you usually collaborate, because you work with so many different musicians. Is there a specific way that you like to work with other people? And what does it take to collaborate with Nico Case?
Well, this particular project was like a masterclass. You know, Katie and Laura are both alpha personalities who are in charge of their own careers, mm-hmm. and I'm in charge of mine. And they do things completely differently than I do. And, you know, I'm in the band The New Pornographers, which is also collaborative, but it's in a different way. I take a backseat as far as, you know, veto power. Like, I come up with some ideas, and I have some of my own parts I make up, but for the most part, I'm doing what Carl and Dan's songs call for, and, you know, Carl will have parts written out that I will just kind of emulate, and then I might make up my own part or whatever, but, and that's very freeing, because I don't have to make big decisions. I can just go in and be the guy who does what they want, which is really fun as well. And then in my own band, I could write songs on my own, but I got in a band in the first place because I like the sense of camaraderie and playing with other people. So I will generally choose to work with other people over writing it by myself, which is a little on the lonely side.
Okay. You know, you mentioned Kelly Hogan, Chicago, of course. You know, you came here to Chicago in the late 90s, 99 or so. Talk about making that move, that transition to come here to Chicago. What drew you to Chicago and the music scene here?
There was just a lot of like-minded folks, and people were really open. And there seemed to be kind of like a central, you know, the Hideout and Bloodshot were two of the things that made it very appealing. And, you know, having met Kelly and Tom Ray and a bunch of other musicians, as well as satellite musicians like Son Rawhouse, even though he didn't live in Chicago, he worked out of there a lot. It just was a good place to be. And, you know, I had just moved back to Seattle from Vancouver where I was going to school, and honestly, my heart was a little broken, A, because, you know, I had to leave Canada because my visa was up and I didn't want to stay there illegally. That would have been not to the point. And, you know, I worked there a lot. I wasn't going to risk my being able to come and go. And then I moved back to Seattle, which was so different than when I left it, and it was unaffordable. There was no central feeling of community at all. It was just all commerce. And, you know, all the musicians there had kind of been dwarfed by the real estate movement. And a lot of people had moved and et cetera. And so Chicago was kind of calling. It felt good. And I thought, well, I'd like to mix it up. You know, I'd like to live in Chicago because I'd always had a real affection for it. And the Midwesterners there are very friendly, and it's a lot of fun. And I'm so glad I did it.
Well, I mean, you're a big part of that scene at the Hideout. You mentioned Bloodshot Records and quote-unquote, I guess, alt-country scene here in Chicago. But that scene, you know, has blown up in the way that so many people have come out of it, and it really is. You know, some have had John in here and Kelly and talked about this being sort of the epicenter of that kind of Americana music outside of maybe the hipper parts of Nashville. Talk about, you know, being a part of that. And you were a big part of that. I mean, the idea of you being a Chicago resident and making music seemed to propel that Chicago had a scene more than just sort of a calm community.
Well, I don't think I can take any credit for that. I was just fortunate enough to be there while it was going on. Like, I don't know that I started any of the momentum. I think I more benefited from it than propelled it, but I am still very, very, like, all the great friends I made in Chicago are the core of my family to this day.
What do you think made that scene move? I mean, what did make it propel? What was it that made more music lovers from around the country pay attention to what was happening with you, with Kelly, with others that were performing here and making music in Chicago?
I don't know. I think there was just this joy. There was a joy to it. And I often, you know, when I'm thinking about it, of course, I see, you know, Bloodshot, and I see a lot of John Langford, Sally Timms, and a lot of those other folks as well. They just made happenings all the time. You know, there was always things going on that, I don't know, people felt like they were definitely in the songs and a part of the band, even if they weren't in the band. Like, as the audience, it definitely was very obvious that the band existed because of the audience and vice versa. You know, it was very group oriented, and it was such a joyful, just like a swift, brisk energy that was very hopeful.
You know, you got out of Chicago. I mean, you moved on from it. Do you miss being a part of Chicago and being here on a daily basis?
I do. I moved out of Chicago because I just couldn't afford it. Like, you know, it was $500,000 for a house seen on Cops. It was at the time. It was the bubble was huge, and you know, our apartment that was really cheap was owned by some really terrible people, and it just wasn't going to last. And so I thought, well, I should take myself to where I can afford to live and actually work. So I ended up moving to Tucson for about 7 years, which was also great. I missed Tucson too, but I mean, what happened with Chicago is happening everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not an isolated thing, unfortunately.
But I guess as a fan of music and a fan of art and a fan of having a creative class here in Chicago, it's hard to hear that, you know, you, Nico Case, couldn't afford to live here because of what's happening in the city. It's hard to swallow.
Well, it's happening to artists everywhere. I mean, it's not, like I said, it's kind of the most prevalent thing, really. I mean, Seattle, that was basically what had already happened in Seattle was happening to Chicago. And I realized, well, I'm not going to be able to make a future for myself here in that way.
Nico Case is going to be part of the show, the supergroup Case, Lang, and Veers at Chicago Theater this Sunday night. Before I let you go, you know, for your solo work specifically, are you working on new music? Can we expect anything from you coming up in the near future?
Yes. I'm actually going to start working on a new record in October, November, which is why we have some live dates on the West Coast coming up then. So, yeah.
All right.
And the new Pornographers have been recording as well. So.
Well, I speak for all of Chicago and say, yay. That's good. Nico Case, guest tonight. She's going to be performing at Chicago Theater this Sunday night, part of the supergroup Case, Lang, and Veers. It's at Chicago Theater. I can't thank you enough for taking some time out, and good luck with the show and the rest
thank
of the music.
Thank you so much.
Always fun to have someone of Nico Case's stature on the program. She's a real deal. You know, the show obviously being able to just get an email from Katie Lang. Hey, I like your music. You want to hang out? Sure. I guess it just makes me think of like, you know, how easy it is if you're a celebrity. If you're good at music and you're a celebrity, that other celebrities email you. Hey, you want to do this? I mean, we kind of talk about it all the time about relationships and people. And that's how great art is produced, especially at the level when they're being, they're big in commerce. You know, we talk about it, Hollywood people, all the time. I mean, the idea of two great comedians coming together is just based on the fact that they know each other, not necessarily like two agents being like, I think, what if we had this project? And it's the same here. Like, you couldn't even dream up a Katie Lang, Laura Veers, Nico Case project. You know what I mean? Like, guys in Sony Music around the conference room. Brilliant idea. Brilliant idea, guys. Three names. Katie Lang, Nico Case, and Melissa Etheridge. And they're like, just doesn't, Okay, scratch Melissa Etheridge. What if I told you I could get Carol Burnett? No, it's just not. It's not ringing. Terrence, it's not. I don't know. It's okay. Well, let's figure it out. You watching the Olympics at home, everybody? Is everybody watching the Olympics? We're opposite the Olympics opening games, which is at the stage now where athletes just kind of walk. We don't know who they are, and they are Facebook Living.
Borat just walked by.
He did look like Borat, didn't he? Big mustache. This is nice. Hey, it's a great show when you can get an Austin Powers and a Borat in.
Very topical.
Too. Very topical show here for everyone out on Michigan Avenue. If you're interested in the way, I mean, real cutting-edge stuff, I can do Borat, Austin Powers. I could throw in a, what's another good one?
Judge Ito. I don't know. I guess he doesn't have one. Ito Shuffle.
Right. A Jay Leno. Yeah, yeah. My Jay Leno is just like my Mayor Daly.
Very similar.
What do you want
to do? Yeah, good.
Yeah, I'll tell you. And I got to get my favorite part of doing a Mayor Daly impression is the, and I have to do, it's so hard to do because it's a skill, but it's where there's no, where punctuation is taken out of sentences. So when he was reading a script, he'd be reading, like, I'll read the Learn How Real Chicagoans Live, right? He'd go, Learn How Real Chicagoans Live the Day to Day. Struggles and successes with health and food. Watch. Living Healthy Chicago Sunday. What do you want me to do? What? I don't want any questions. You tell me. That's essentially a former Mayor Daly press conference.
I miss that guy sometimes.
We're talking about him because right now this could be happening at Soldier Field.
Oh, right?
This could have been
weird
show that's happening right now. And think about what would a 2016 Chicago Olympics opening ceremonies look like? Would it just be like a pay-to-play kind of thing? Or would it just be a bunch of Chicago products like, you know, they do when they bet, two mayors bet over a playoff game? Would it just be a ton of like Robinson Ribs? Stewart's Coffee? Like, here comes the Stewart's Coffee team. Here comes Eli's Cheesecake. Oh, look at that cheesecake. It would just be all of the Chicago products on display. Because at the end of the day, Mayor Daly and company, they wouldn't want to miss the opportunity to sell the products that we produce. There wouldn't be any show, no light show, no Cirque du Soleil. It'd just be all like Jesse White tumblers. It would be... It'd be Wrigley Spearmint Gum. They figure out a way to get that. Oh, look, the Wrigley Spearmint Gum twins are out there. That's great. You like a Portillo's hot dog?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's got to be a lot of stuff.
312, do they make that?
They wouldn't even do 312 and be like, nah, we do Miller Coors. It'd be like, oh, look, take a look here. Miller Lite has its own flag.
And people make fun of NASCAR.
Yeah, right?
For over advertising,
this would be it. If this was the Olympics 2016 in Chicago, I guarantee we would have done everything we possibly could to promote every single product that's made here.
Absolutely.
Why would we miss that opportunity? To be like, ladies, oh look who's got it's Ronnie Woo Woo,
and look up in the Twin Anchors section of the upper deck. Great ribs at Twin Anchors.
Like,
which, by the way, they have good ribs.
They do have good ribs. Also, I mean, all the local characters would be out. It would be good. I don't know what it is, but it just feels like even though Chicago's a world-class city, you know that they would be like, this is all great. I love the LED light show. I love all the acrobats, but it's just not, there's not enough Slozy Edelson enough in this. There's not enough local. Where's Eagle Man?
Bob Roorman.
comes Bob Roorman and the gymnasts. He's with the gymnasts. Oh, it's Bob Roorman. That's exactly what it would be. every
It's so true, though.
Every country would have their athletes. You'd be like, oh, and then they have one representative of a Chicago company with their entourage. So it'd be like, here comes the Russian gymnast. Oh, look at that. Oh, that's great. Oh, it's the guy who owns Garrett's Popcorn, too. Take a look at that big jug of caramel popcorn, throwing it out like candy to a parade.
Don't go crazy. It's nuts on Clark.
Every alderman would be with one of the countries. Oh, here it is, Bert Nateris.
Well, we have just about, you know, as many aldermen to cover all the countries.
I know, right?
So, yeah.
They would have made. They would have actually made more aldermen by the time this went on. So they would have expanded it to 200. There'd be 200 aldermen, and each country would get one, and it'd be like the big clout. Like the bigger countries get the aldermen, like the Berks.
You know? Like aldermen and vice aldermen.
Right, exactly. But if you're a Waugisback, you get stuck with Estonia.
Yeah. Yeah, the country that brings like three athletes.
Bangladesh.
And one of them's a shot putter.
Right, exactly. The Bangladesh team. Oh, we see Alderman Proko Joe Moreno's with them. That's great. We could do this all night, man. So good to be like local musicians. Oh, it's here it is. It's the Ides of March. It's the Survivor. The guys from Survivor are here. They are with the team from Barbados. I'm telling you, man, too much fun. All right, coming up after the news, we are going to hear from Adam Hoge. We're going to get an update on Bears camp. I'm going to ask him tonight, I was thinking about this, where he thinks the Bears are when it comes to the playoff picture. We're talking about camp, and we're getting very specific. We get down to the coaches and the players and all that kind of stuff. I want to talk about Alshon Jeffrey and the mysterious day off for Kevin White. They're giving days off to rookie wide receivers on day six. That can't be good. But I want to ask, like, where are we? I mean, let's get ESPN-y up in here.
And 9-7, Justin, yeah, is here for the Bears just
exactly.
Out of the playoffs.
What do they think? What does Adam think that our chances are in the NFC North? I was going to say Central. In the Central this year. So we'll talk with Adam Hoge coming up after the news. Stay with us.
Let's talk about football and your Chicago Bears. Down, set, punt, or will they punt? Can we get to the Super Bowl, or will we choke? The Bears camp report with Adam Hoge.
That's right. The Bears practice again today. No Kevin White. No Alshon Jeffrey. So essentially some footwork drills for Jay Cutler. We'll talk about the big weekend ahead of us. It's family day. It's our family night where the Bears practice at Soldier Field. Adam Hoge joins us now. WGN Radio Sports. Of course, you can get his stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Intentional Grounding. A new episode up now. Adam, how was the day in Bourbonnais?
Well, Justin, I'm looking at my depth chart right now, and I see the top five pass catchers for Jay Cutler are Kevin White, Alshon Jeffrey, Eddie Royal, Marquise Wilson, and tight end Zach Miller. And all five of those guys were standing on the sideline today.
Wow, that's amazing, man. This is not – I mean, you heard John Fox say it, and others have said that this is training camp. People get nicked up. It's not unusual. But it seems unusual that there are this many injuries this early in camp.
Yeah, and Alshon not practicing again today. You know, they can pass this off as a minor hamstring, whatever they want to call it. But they also called it two different things. They started off by saying it was just muscle tightness. Then the next day they said it was a mild hamstring, and he's still not out there. And this just sounds like the same old story from last year, right, with Alshon Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. And then Kevin White today, apparently just a day off. However, you know, Don Fox gets up at the podium, and I loved his injury report. He goes, well, it's the same as yesterday. Well, except for the fact that one of your tight ends was in the hospital with a lung bruise. How is it the exact same?
Right? What is that?
It wasn't just like there was a minor change. One of his guys was literally in the hospital, and John Fox was trying to pass it off like, oh, there's no changes to the injury report. He doesn't mention Kevin White either, who didn't practice. Someone brought up in their question, well, was it a day off? And he just said yes. So, you know, for all we know, it may have been more than a day off. And I don't blame Bears fans for being skeptical about that, because Kevin White is still a second-year wide receiver. He's not a veteran, and he's never played a down in the NFL.
Right. Why
so
does
what's
he need
he getting,
a day off? Right.
Yeah, why is he getting days off already? So for John Fox not even bring up in the injury report, that seems sketchy to me.
Let me ask: is Danny Trevathan back? Is he practicing?
Yes, he's been out
right,
there.
Okay, that's
yeah,
good.
He got back out there the day after suffered that little knee tweak. He's been a little bit limited, but he should be fine.
Okay, so tomorrow night, the Bears go to Soldier Field for their goofy family night where they practice under the lights and people can come
watch. It's actually
watch
during the day now.
Is it during the day?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a rip-off.
Yeah, Fox moved it to a nice 12:30 practice.
Oh, no. Who's going to Soldier Field at 12:30?
I don't know. I am. I'll be there.
Yeah, exactly. No one's really going anyway. But the so what happens if – I mean, is there anything special, or is it really just a glorified practice?
What's different is that they will have three sets of 12 plays for each of their first team, second team, third string team, and they'll actually do a little scrimmage in there. So they'll be scripted out, but the offense and defense will go live for 12 plays, other than the quarterback. You obviously still can't hit the quarterback, but other than that, it'll be tackle football. And so that's a little entertaining for the fans that show up, can actually see that. And I enjoyed watching that last year from the sideline, and even though it's a very limited amount of plays, to actually see them go live and kind of simulate a game, it's a little bit of a change of pace from these normal training camp practices.
Okay, so I was talking to Rob right before we brought you in, and we haven't had the conversation yet. I mean, we've pretty really drilled down on what's happening at camp. But the Bears, coming off a 6-10 season, there were points last year where they were either a game out or, sort of tied for first place in the NFC North, and then they had a terrible end to the season. But where did the Bears stack up when it comes to the other teams in the NFC North? Do the Bears, when it comes to the other, the experts at the big national place, are they getting any respect?
Well, I don't think they're getting much respect. I mean, just, kind of keeping an eye on the NFL Network, and I don't really watch ESPN all that much anymore, but from time to time, you have that on. The Bears seem to just not really be part of the national conversation right now, but that's okay, and I understand it. The Vikings won the division last year, and the Packers are always going to be good and in there, and I think the Bears are probably the third best team in the division, and I don't know that there's all that much separation, at least that you can prove, between them and the Lions right now. But I do think, just in my own rankings of the division, that's how I would put it. I think you bring up a fair point, though, that this team was sort of in the mix last year when they went into Green Bay and won that game on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That's pretty late in the season at that point. They were right there in the playoff race after they won that game. Obviously, they didn't finish very strong, but a lot of that had to do with a lack of depth and a lot of injuries. So you start over, it's a new year, and I think the Bears have improved their depth. I don't know that they've done it enough to, be a playoff caliber team, be able to win a game in the playoffs, but that's part of the process that Ryan Pace and John Fox are trying to build here. This is a rebuilding project, even though they don't want to call it that. So I expect improvement. I expect them to win some of those games, those close games that they lost last year.
Right.
And you could argue that two of them they should have won anyway. If Robbie Gould, the guy who you depend on, just makes his kick. So, they weren't that far off last year despite so many shortcomings. That's why I look at this and say that this is a team that should be in the mix in December. Will they make the playoffs? I don't know. I don't even think that's a fair, expectation for them. But I wouldn't rule it out either.
Who? I'm just thinking of the NFC. Is the NFC in general, is it a strong conference? Obviously the Carolina Panthers went to the Super Bowl and they were pretty unstoppable all the way through until losing in the Super Bowl. Is the NFC, did a lot of teams retool? Are the same teams that were good last year, they look to be good again this year?
Well, the nice thing about the NFL is that teams can kind of rebuild quickly, and there's always a surprise team, and then there's always a team that you look at that has high expectations that fall off. And that's kind of the fun part of the conversation this time of year. But, I think it's a strong conference, the NFC. I think the Bears happen to be in a very strong division with the Vikings and the Packers. I guess you could say the Vikings could fall back to earth a little bit, but I think that defense is so strong that they won't. You look at the South, the Panthers, I think are going to be strong again. And then the Falcons, Bucks, and Saints, I don't really know what to expect from those three teams. It's kind of up in the air. But out west, Seattle's going to be strong, and I think Arizona can just keep building on what they did last year. And then there's the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah,
the Bears have
East,
to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Bears have to play Dallas on the road early on in the season.
Who do the Bears play in terms of the conference? Are they playing the East, the NFC East this year?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's that could be one way or the other, right?
Yeah, they play the NFC East and the AFC South this year.
Okay.
So, and then their crossover games are the Buccaneers on the road again, and the 49ers come back.
That's
to
That's not that tough. It's so early in the season, but the AFC South, the Colts are coming off a terrible year. Andrew Luck will be back. Talk about the Houston Texans, the Jacksonville Jaguars are supposed to be a little bit better, but those are beatable teams. They have been in the past. And as you mentioned, the Buccaneers, they're in a transition. It just feels to me as if this is a little bit more favorable of a schedule for the Bears.
It probably is a little bit, although I look
last
at
last year they played the first three or four games was against like Super Bowl contenders.
Yeah, and it was a tough start. And, you know, this year's going to be a tough start, too. The Cowboys should be a lot better this year. I mean, Tony Romo's going to be healthy, and they should be a better team. And that makes it tough having to go on the road to Dallas. You have to go on the road to New York to face the Giants. These are not easy games. You know, and you mentioned the Colts, which another team that I look at like the Cowboys. It should bounce back and be much stronger, and that's another road game. There certainly will be a lot of Bears fans in Indy, but that's another road game. And then you're also you're starting the season in Houston against the playoff team. Now the question there is if J.J. Watt plays, and we'll certainly be watching that over the coming weeks.
And a new quarterback, right.
And, yeah, they have a new quarterback in Brock Osweiler, but Osweiler beat the Bears last year.
Yeah,
at Soldier
that's
Field.
One of those games I wish they had back.
It's one they should have won.
They should have won that game. The Broncos were just not in it the entire game, and the Bears just let them have it. And you know, there's something to be said about that's what we expect Vic Fangio and John Fox to do, is to tighten up those games where in the last three or four years we've seen us losing those close games. I'd like to see us win those.
And I think they can, but I just looking at this team through a week and a half of training camp, the depth still looks thin to me. And so to see, you know, I think I was on with you Monday or Tuesday, and I was talking about how, okay, it hasn't been that bad of a camp so far in terms of injuries. And then all of a sudden, in like 3 days, things got really bad in a hurry. Nothing season ending, it doesn't look like, but still, to have Alshon Jeffrey not on the practice field, Kevin White again today, and Zach Miller's out, all of a sudden you're looking at the same offense as Jay Cutler had last year, except you're also subtracting Matt Forte, and that's worrisome, I think, going into the season.
I'm interested in the defensive side of the ball because it feels like, you know, quietly, I mean, they're being very quiet this camp, but there's a lot of expectations with the new linebackers that are here. Hopefully everyone can stay healthy. But this concept, especially on the with the rookie, with the draft class, that you might actually maybe see some playmakers that start turning heads that have been drafted from Ryan Pace and John Fox regime.
Yeah, Eddie Goldman and Lamar Houston would probably be those two guys that really stick out as the young guys from the Ryan Pace drafts, the two that he's had, that they're hoping really have good years. I mean, I think especially with Eddie Goldman, they think the sky is the limit for a former second-round pick who played a lot last year.
Yeah, that's a huge place, yeah.
He's lost some weight. They think his conditioning is going to be better this year to be able to play more downs, and he really has to because there's not much depth there at all. And then it'll be interesting to watch Jonathan Bullard, this year's third-round pick on the defensive line, too. He's a guy that could turn some heads and push for a starting job once we move into the season. But I think the good news here is that there's actually players from the previous regime, specifically Lamar Houston and Willie Young, who I think look just poised to have a huge season if they can stay healthy. They look like really, really good shape right now, and tough for that offensive line, which I don't even think is playing all that bad right now in camp so far. So I do think the front seven all of a sudden looks like a strength for this team.
That's
when they've really struggled for 3 years.
That's what we want to see as Bears fans. I like Lamar Houston. I mean, obviously he'll always be remembered for getting hurt and while he's doing a sack dance when they're getting their butt kicked. But he came off the edge last year when he seemed to start to get back from that injury, and he showed a little pop. He showed that promise, you know, when we were all excited when he got signed to that big contract coming out of Oakland.
Well, he ended up leading the team in sacks last year, which is crazy to think about when he was so limited early on in the year and at times struggled to even see the field. You know, I think back of Willie Young, people forget this. He was a healthy scratch in Seattle week three last year. And everyone
thought he was on his way out,
Everyone thought he was going to get traded. Now, the next day they traded Jared Allen instead, and that allowed Willie to get back in there. So they probably made I don't know. You could look at that both ways. You could say maybe they put Jared out there to show other teams that he could still play, or you could say that maybe they shouldn't have put him out there if they were trying to trade him because he could have gotten hurt. But either way, Willie then got more of an opportunity later in the season, and he came on strong as well in the second half. And I think he's poised to have a big year, and they just rewarded him with a contract extension.
You know, one of the things last year at the beginning of the year, and I'm loving this conversation, Adam, because it's like reminding me of a lot of things last year that I had problems with. But at the beginning of the year when they had to play those teams, a lot of what we were talking about, you and I were talking about on the show, but also just the way that the Bears team was playing out, was they had a lot of guys in the wrong positions. And a lot of guys who were like, Jared Allen's going to try to be an outside linebacker. Let's see how that works. And it was a lot. It just felt like, Kyle Long's going to move over to the other side. Have they rectified that? Do you feel this year when they come into camp that they got the right personnel for what they're trying to do?
Yeah, and I think that you got to realize that it was really hard for them to take guys from really, that last regime was just a complete failure, right? So you're taking all these guys, and then you're switching your defense. And I think that you actually have to give Ryan Pace and John Fox a lot of credit for being as patient as they were. They could have put off the move from the 4-3 to the 3-4, you know, a year, while, you know, trying to get the most out of the previous personnel that they inherited. And instead they said, no. We're doing what we're going to do. We're going to find out who can play it and who can't, and we're going to get rid of the guys who can't. So it was pretty obvious early on that it just wasn't going to work for Jared Allen. So they said goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, Willie Young, they identified a guy that they thought could make the transition to a 3-4, and it ended up working out by the end of the year, and now they've signed him for three more seasons to be a part of this defense. I think that says a lot. Now, Lamar Houston played in a 3-4 in Oakland before, so he was kind of used to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't really work for Shea McClellan and Christian Jones as inside linebackers at 3-4. So they let Shea go, and they moved Christian Jones to the outside. So they're adapting, and they're finding out who can play and who can't. And I think you're going to continue to see this. I mean, there's two guys in Ego Ferguson and Will Sutton who were drafted by the previous regime into a different defense. And right now I don't see anything from them that says that they can still play in this 3-4. So they might be guys who end up getting cut by the end of this
month. Oh, man, that's going to be a good conversation coming up about who doesn't make this team.
Yeah.
All right, so have a great family day tomorrow at Soldier Field, and we'll catch up next week, and we'll get us prepared for the preseason game on Thursday. You know, it's interesting. We're talking tonight after 10 o'clock. Jack Silverstein's going to join us. We're going to do the 10th anniversary of the Super Bowl team. We're going to start that conversation because we're going to have some of those players on the download coming up this fall. I didn't realize this, but Robbie Gould's the only Bear left playing in the league from that team. We just went through the whole roster. He's the last guy playing. And it's really interesting. Do the Bears at all, and I'll ask you this and I'll let you go. The Bears at all, are they planning anything to honor the fact that it's 10 years, an anniversary, kind of like what the White Sox did with the World Series Championship?
I mean, they didn't win, so. Yeah, I haven't heard anything about it, so they probably I'll ask. I can ask around. Well, it would surprise me if they
– Yeah, I mean,
they should do something for one game.
Yeah, because it'd be fun to have all those guys come back out, you know, just to be able to see a lot of the guys who, you know, are now retired. You know, Ryan Urlacher.
That's crazy that was
10 years ago. And what's and last question? Where's Devin Hester? It's not happening. He's not coming back to Chicago.
Well, he hasn't signed with anybody yet. So,
let's bring that price down. Let's get him here.
I mean, that tells me that he's not healthy.
Oh man.
But maybe he's still trying to get healthy, and maybe we'll see him again by the end of the season, or maybe signs later in the month with some other team. But I think right now, you know, this regime's kind of sticking to what they're doing. They want to go young. They want to go with their players. And I think you can make an argument for bringing Devin Hester back, but I don't think it's going
to
happen.
The Bears have had a couple of – they've done that. They've been a team that has liked to bring back players. I remember Richard Dent came back, back like in the 90s under – I think it was under Wanstead when they're like, we brought him back, and he was already over the hill. But so there
Foxy
is
– Foxy doesn't seem very sentimental to me, though.
There you go. Hopefully, maybe they can get like some of those old Jake Delhomme to come back, you know, and play play back up corner. Adam Hogue, WGN Radio Sports, WGNRadio.com/Bears. His new podcast is up there, Intentional Grounding, and you can catch out all his information. He'll be on the air tomorrow on the beat at 3 o'clock, right?
Yep, right after Family Day. I'll be right on the air at 3 o'clock, and we'll have plenty of Bears talk and other sports as well.
Sounds good. Talk to you next week, Adam. Thanks.
All right, thanks, Justin.
Are you playing this beat for Devin Hester? Don't go chasing waterfalls. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. I don't know. I wish they'd bring Devin back. I know. John, Coach, can I call you that? John Fox, can I call you John? It'd go a long way. We were watching some of those clips today because we're going to talk with Jack Silverstein coming up about the 10-year anniversary. And I've never seen anything like it. I mean, some of those returns that Devin Hester brought. I mean, obviously he was a rookie that season. So, you know, I understand he's now, it's 15 years in the league or whatever it's been, 10 years. But still, you know, it's just there's something sentimental about having number 23 back there to return punts.
It would be great.
Maybe he can come back and just be a color commentator.
I don't know about that.
Break down the game. Devin Hester. Hester's Corner. I'm trying to think of inside the 20. That's what we call it. Inside the 20.
Yeah,
with Devin
very good.
Hester.
Yeah, I think you're, as much as I love that team, you know, that defense was fabulous. You're right. They lost in the Super Bowl. So it's
honor them.
It's like when I get really irritated when I'm at a Cubs game and I see people trotting out the 1969 stuff. I'm like, you won nothing.
You didn't even
you blew
get to
it
the
everything.
Yeah, weren't, but and it'd be like saying, like, oh, we're bringing it to a 10-year anniversary of the Lou Piniella team.
Yeah.
With Derek Lee and
yeah.
Aramis Ramirez. You'd be
they
like,
did nothing.
Yeah, I don't know if that's much of an anniversary. I don't know, but there's maybe it's because it's the Bears and the Bears never win. The idea of getting to the Super Bowl, and that team was a very dominant team, you know? It was the kind of thing where you felt really like this was a special team. It's the same thing we would say about the 85 Bears, that team didn't do enough to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that team fell apart. I mean, you remember early, and we'll talk with Jack, I don't want to waste it all. Luis is coming up next. We're going to talk about reservations and dining, and that's going to be a good one. 312-981-7200. But remember, that team was dominant. Like at the beginning of the year, they shut out the Packers. They weren't just winning games towards the end of the year, they started doing that. But the first couple games, they beat the Bills, they beat the 49ers, they beat the Packers, as I mentioned. They were blowouts. It was Rex Grossman on a fly route to Bernard Berrien, and it was like 41-0. I mean, they trashed teams. You know, And there were a couple close come from behind games at Arizona Monday night game. I mean, I think they ended up in that season being 13-3 or 12-4.
Yeah.
They kind of the last couple games they didn't care about. So anyway, all right, coming up, Luis Achiu. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. If you're keeping score, Spain is making their way in to the Olympic Arena in Brazil. I understand the athletes are very excited to be there. It's an amazing opportunity, and you know, they've worked their entire lives. But put the phones down. It's a million phones. Every athlete's got a phone, like they're Facebook Living or they're keeping it for, you know, their own. They're going to put it on Instagram. But come on. Like, at least I give Micronesia some credit. No phones. 9 athletes, no phones. That's how I would do my Olympics. You know, the Micronesia coach is like, hey, put it away. Turn it off. Savor the moment. The Spain coach is like, oh, man, let's get this up on Twitter, Instagram, social media, España Facebook.
You know? They're very connected over there. I was over there, yeah. Maybe they'll get the signals in Micronesia. So.
I think they do. I think that I believe Micronesia, they're like, yo, man, we got so much technology. There's so much technology, but the coach is like, live in the moment.
Yeah.
Right? He stopped everyone. This is what I think happened. In the tunnel, they're like, Micronesia is like, stop. Put your phones away. Live in the moment. You'll never forget this moment. Let's do it. And then they came out. United States of America coming out now. Michael Phelps holding the flag. He doesn't have a phone, see?
Yeah. Well, he's got both hands on the flagpole, too. So.
Looking good. Not too many phones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe they did the same thing. Maybe the U.S. coach was like, guys, put away the phones.
Good outfits.
See if they show the men's basketball team. I would assume that Jimmy Butler and the is in this... this crew. I don't have the sound on, so I don't know if they're actually getting booed.
Uh-oh. Sailed the cruise ship up.
right. All right. So the Olympics are continuing. They're doing the March of Countries right now, the United States of America. So they're getting close to Brazil, who I believe is last, right? Even though that's out of alphabetical order. So total cheat. But they're last because they're the home country.
Closing act.
They're the closing act.
Yeah,
main
act.
We'll see if they're on their phones.
Yeah.
All right. In studio with me, Luis Achiu. How are you? Good to see you.
Good, Justin. How are you?
I'm good. Chicago Tribune food reporter and half of the podcast Chewing, which you can find at the Chicago Tribune site, and a frequent guest here on the Download. Monica Eng is on vacation.
Yep.
Much needed. vacation. She said she would call. Well, you know what? Right. We have the heart and soul here, Louisa.
Oh, all right,
so we're going to
no.
talk about your newest podcast that just came out, which is really focused on the south side of Chicago.
Yes.
And then we're also going to talk about this big issue, which I think is an issue that's been in restaurants for a while now. But Jason Vincent from Giant, Jason Vincent, who was on our program, we talked about starting this restaurant, kind of went to Facebook in the last 2 weeks and said, you know what? I'm getting burned by people not showing up for their reservations.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, am I, as a restaurateur, a small business operator, someone who doesn't have a lot of tables in his Logan Square restaurant.
Yeah.
Can I charge somebody? Should I charge somebody when they don't show up for their reservation?
Right.
This caused a little bit of a firestorm.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was a really hot commented thread on his Facebook. And I mean, it's actually a public thread, so you can go and check it out. So Jason Vincent, as most people who listen to your interview with him, which they can listen to on the podcast as well, know that he's, you know, was previously the chef in Knightwood, now open Giant in Logan Square, 40 seats. And even though Logan Square is a really hot neighborhood, I mean, it's kind of a quiet strip that he's on in Armitage. So again, 40 seats is nothing in the restaurant business.
And he
right
chose,
now.
They chose it. We talked about it and he said, we chose to do that. I didn't want to have this huge sprawling restaurant.
Right. And he posts on his own personal Facebook page over this past weekend asking if basically for suggestions from his colleagues, from everybody.
Right.
Should he charge a no-show? And he was so upset and concerned about it. And I was thinking, wow, like how much is their no-show fee, you know? And so I, being the reporter.
Right,
that
the investigative reporter
exactly,
that you are.
Got on my computer on the internets and tried to, you know, so made a, started a reservation on, so went to the Giant website, started a reservation, and I'm like, wow, how much was this fee that he's like so fretting over, right? How much?
How much?
$20.
$20.
$20.
So if I don't go, if I make a reservation for Giant, which I do have one coming up in the next couple weeks here,
so,
and I don't go, he's going to charge me $20.
Well, here's the thing is that if you change or cancel your reservation 24 hours before.
Like a dentist.
Right. Much better. Like a way better experience than a dentist, you know. And they give you like three levels of like, hey, hello, please be aware of this, you know. And that if you change or cancel within 24 hours, they may charge you. Actually, they couch language saying like they may charge you $20 a person, right? And you're thinking, I'm going to go because I really want to go to this restaurant, hot new restaurant, great. Like every single thing I've ever eaten by him has been amazing. And so that's, like, pretty reasonable. So, however, like, you know, even though a lot of people jump in and say, like, oh, the guys, that, you know, whoever it was, didn't show up, was a jerk, blah, blah, things happen.
Yeah, let's talk about this because there has been, I mean, you said it's a spirited comment thread, to say the least.
Yeah, like 100
but a lot
comments.
But a lot of the comments were no way. They were, let's say, it's unethical to charge somebody. That is an unwritten contract, essentially, that says, you know, we're going to reserve a table for you because you've chosen our restaurant. But it's not a binding contract that says that if I don't show up for that quote-unquote reservation, I should be charged.
Right.
And there, people will come back and say, okay, well, it was a rainy night and I don't have a car.
Right.
I had three reservations or I had too many people that were in the press, so I went somewhere else. I mean, there's a lot of different things that happened. I was
exactly.
sick.
Yeah. Well, what was really interesting is that a lot of people that commented on this thread, which like 100 comments, were restaurant professionals here in Chicago who said, you can't charge. You know, you shouldn't charge, really. It's just like what you do. And they suggested maybe if he could say, hey, instead of charging you, I'm going to charge you, but send you like the same amount in gift certificates so you'll come back. And that's what I thought was just really amazing and fascinating, that the fact that Jason is like sweating $20. You know, I mean, I don't know how big the party was, you know, and that so many restaurant professionals here in Chicago are saying like, you know, don't do it. Even though it's like on the reservation page,
it says
like three times.
We will charge you.
Yeah. And that's, I just think, really telling about how the culture here is in Chicago, because other places
may do it, right?
Will do it.
New York
for sure.
is like, I'm doing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So fast.
Well, I want to hear what you have to say, Download Nation. Would you be okay with being charged a no-show fee for a reservation, $20, $40, the price of a meal? 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Because I'm kind of, I see it both ways. I mean, Jason's got a small business in Logan Square, and he's it's not like people are standing in line outside to take that reservation. But at the same time, you know what? This is a business that is based on customer service.
Yeah.
And it's a business that the customer's always right, and you kind of have to deal with the fact that the customer may not show up.
Well, and actually, they may not be physically standing in line there because, you know, even though it's a hot neighborhood, but they may have been standing in line online. You know, I mean, because I read in that comment thread, too, people, it shows sold out. You know, I want to go reserve, and there's certain times that are sold out.
Right.
And so, and again, actually, $20 has not even come close to covering me, even though his prices are pretty reasonable. I mean, you lose a table for
absolutely
a night.
Yeah,
it's like, how does a small business in Chicago survive if people are, you know, short attention span? And I'm not saying, and again, not to blame, not to judge, you know, that it's like this person necessarily had short attention span or just blew it off. Something may have happened.
But you know what? I will blame and judge.
Yeah, let's you say, will, let's, Justin.
I mean, but that is the, I mean, there is a little sort, I mean, I would say that's almost the deal. Meaning, yes, I want to come, I'm going to reserve this chair, and I'm going to pay you $150 or whatever Jason's charging with wine and food and everything. And if I can't go, you're not going to get the money. It's because we didn't have that transactional service.
Right.
So I wonder if this is a larger conversation, and we're having it.
Yeah.
Is about the idea that we've seen Nick Kokonis and others try to change the way restaurant reservations work because it just doesn't work at the end of the day.
Well, it does for some. And actually, that was a conversation that too was in the thread. So as a lot of people might know about Tock, which is a Chicago, and you had Nick on as well, Chicago-based reservation service, which actually sells tickets to restaurants like you would to a play or a movie now. Remember?
Right.
Like the old days, you could just go show up at a movie. And so the deal with that is that you buy the ticket to the restaurant, and if you can't make it, you know, whatever, it's your job to go and resell that ticket somewhere that you can't just call up and cancel. It's sold. It's done. It's a done deal. And so, you know, as far as the $20, I mean, I think that somebody who went through the effort of making the reservation, entering in all your credit card information, you know, I mean, you know what the deal is. I think that.
And that's new, too, the idea that they're, I mean, all right, keep going.
No, I mean, I think that the kind of person who would want to go there, I think they would be okay with it. Like I said, I thought it was very interesting that Jason was so thoughtful about the whole situation and that so many people in the restaurant business in Chicago, that's how they would handle it. I think I might have another solution, though.
All right. Well, yeah. We'll get to that solution after the break here. 312-981-7200. The texts are coming in. People are on the line. I want to hear from you guys what you think about the idea of getting charged for not showing up for a reservation. That's what we're talking about here with Louisa Chu, Chicago Tribune food reporter on The Download. Stay with us. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin, Louisa Chu from Chicago Tribune, food reporter in studio with me. Also, her podcast, Chewing, her and Monica Eng as well, is a new episode is out covering the South Side.
On the South Side.
And we'll talk about that this hour. And you can find that. The podcast is also at the Chicago Tribune.
Yep. Just go to the Chicago Tribune dining page, chicagotribune.com/dining.
Okay. So we're talking about restaurants, reservations, and whether or not you should be charged if you don't show. Or if you cancel within a small period of time, meaning if it's like an hour before or 2 hours before. I don't know. I feel like that's something that happens, right? Where you're like, okay, I'm not going to dinner right now. I just, the idea that, I don't know. There's part of me that I feel, I'm feeling myself right now. That sounded gross.
Okay.
But
all right.
I would say that I'm going in the direction. I'm feeling like, you know what? I don't like the system that says I have to get charged if I don't go to dinner.
Right.
You know, like I'm not a big fan of that. I feel like at a certain point, you know what? That's just a game that's been set up and there wasn't actually a transaction. So why should I be changed money? That's just let's try other people. Let's see. 312-981-7200 is a number. Monica, you're on the line. What's your thought on this?
Well, I have no problem if they would want to charge me because I do always cancel when I have to cancel. Just because they're running a business and if you have plans to meet somebody, you show up. However, I would want the same assurance from them that if I show up for my 8 o'clock reservation and my table isn't sitting there waiting for me, I would like $20 a person
there
to
have. There you go. A lot of $20 bills rolling around now. You're right, Monica.
Or whatever, you know, or whatever. I think that's only fair. Just the same way I sent a doctor a bill once for quadruple booking and keeping me waiting an hour and 10 minutes.
Oh, no.
Can I use your services, Monica? Can you help me in situations like that? I got a washing machine problem.
But
yeah,
right. Thanks, Monica.
But you know, but I appreciate Monica's point. But again, like the doctor situation, it's not depending on necessarily the restaurant, but the other customers and the other patients. So, like, I totally understand. I don't want to be waiting an hour and a half either. But do we then penalize the business if somebody's just hanging out there?
Charge them for hanging out too long.
Exactly.
Put a timer on it.
Hand them a
bill. See, it's a slippery slope. It's not unlike regulation, these Democrats with their regulation.
Right, exactly. But what we could do as hospitality professionals, because, you know, I grew up in the restaurant business.
Oh,
and,
here we go.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And so what you could do in that sort of situation is you can make nice. I mean, it's pretty easy. You send somebody out a drink. You send somebody out, like a snack, something that appreciates, like, say, I'm really sorry. It's not our fault. But we're really sorry this is happening, mm-hmm. and we really appreciate you hanging out there. And these days now, a lot of places, especially in Logan Square, you can send them to someplace else, like nearby, and say, hey, have a drink on us. We'll text you as soon as we're ready.
That's true.
That happens all the time.
All right, let's try Julie. Julie, you're on the line. Julie, what are you thinking on this issue of charging for missing reservations?
You know, I get it. I'm lifelong in the restaurant business as well, from fine dining to all kinds of restaurants. I completely get it. And this is a small restaurant with probably no more than a dozen tables if it's 40 seats. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the margins are very small. At the end of the day, though, and by the way, I agree with the restaurateur. He should be able to charge. But here's why I would say avoid it if you can. Because at the end of the day, in our business, what you don't want is you don't want any customer, for whatever reason, for any reason, talking negatively about your business.
Right.
And if you get charged, you bet your bottom dollar they're going to tell some friends about it, and it's going to be negative sort of publicity on your restaurant. And so what I would suggest is maybe some other creative ways of doing this. So as an example, let's say that he has, I don't know, 12 tables in his restaurant. Don't reserve all 12. Reserve 8.
Yeah.
And then have the others as first come, first serve.
Yeah.
Do a wait list and tell people that, you know what, at 3 o'clock the day of, if we have any availability, we'll give you a call. Or feel free to check back with us tomorrow between 3 and 5. We may have a table open up. Okay. And so there's creative ways. The other thing that I would do is, because I ran a fine dining restaurant at Ravinia, and we had a few members that were notorious for canceling at the last minute. And these were on sold out shows. And so, you know what? So basically what I did was, when these people made reservations, if they called for a reservation on a night that I knew was going to be a busy packed night, mm-hmm. I would tell them that I'm actually full that evening, but let me put you on a wait list in case I have a table.
Oh, they got blacklisted.
I wouldn't risk, you know, so the people handling reservations at this restaurant could, could keep a list going internally of phone numbers or names of people that have canceled.
Yeah, now you're getting all Senator McCarthy on us. Like, I feel like
I would. It's a business. You know, it's a business.
You're but right. Okay.
If you go to Stephanie Eisert's place, if you go to the Girl and the Goat, for example, they take reservations. Good luck getting a reservation 2 months from now. However, they do have a section in the bar area that is either like it's a communal table, or you can sit at the bar. That's first come, first serve. Mm-hmm. And so this might be a suggestion here, that I think could be managed appropriately. Another place I used to work with, we used to overbook by a certain amount of tables because we knew that every night, especially on the weekends, we would get 3 or 4 no-shows. And so
they overbook.
We overbooked.
Interesting.
You know?
I like it, though. I like what you're saying. Thank you, Julie. Thank you for that. I that's another thing that, I mean, now you get into the game where restaurants are protecting themselves or overbooking, but what if everybody shows up?
Julie. So one thing is that Jason does reserve some tables for walk-ins and says so on their website and his, you know, his social media. And that's what a lot of restaurants do, even the ones that sell tickets like Tok, you know, I mean, they have this, they can set aside a certain percentage. And the tricky thing, though, and trust me, a lot of these, I mean, all these reservation systems, they're all about the data. And so they have all of those things. I mean, it's like everyone's, exactly. It's like, you know, if you reserve through OpenTable, you don't show up. It's like, hey, how come you didn't show up? Or how come, you know, like you canceled? You know, I mean,
we had Kevin Bayman here from Boca, and he was saying that they go as far as to they know all about you.
Absolutely.
Coming in, they're like, they're playing, they're playing music in the house.
That's a
like if
creepy.
You're a big, if you're a big timer,
right?
They're like, they're throwing little, like your favorite song on while you're eating.
That's very creepy, actually.
Let's go to Marianne. Let's go to Marianne. Marianne, what do you think? You make a reservation, you can't go. Should you be charged?
No way. I was in the restaurant business my whole life, and let me tell you what. Logan Square, downtown Chicago. There are so many restaurants to go to that if you want to go out to dinner and they're going to charge you, then you know what? Then they're gonna lose. I think they're going to lose business. I mean, again, you're going to get clientele who may not care if they get charged, but that's not the average person. And like I said, there's too many restaurants in this world to be having to pay a restaurant.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to a doctor's appointment where you have, you know, you need specific care. You know, you
some
go
might
to a
say
doctor.
That the wine list is specific care.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you've ever had his crispy pig ears. So
thank
like
you.
I've managed restaurants for years, and from fine dining to casual dining. And let me tell you what, it's all how you treat your
customers.
Yeah,
right on.
And you know what? And if these restaurants that do take reservations and it takes months for people to get in there, well, then people need to, they know they need to make reservations months out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Marianne.
You know. And, all right. Thanks.
Yeah. And to be clear, I think that the resolution was basically that bottom line was like I was saying, it's like everybody saying, you know, it's not the Chicago restaurant culture. Don't charge. Get in touch. If you're going to charge anything, give him a credit to the restaurant, you know? So, I mean, to be clear, he really, like I said, sweated this whole thing, and I'm guessing he did not charge.
And to be honest, I mean, even beyond Jason's issue, this is an issue that's been out there before. I mean, obviously what Nick Kokonis did with Tok or promoting Tok, and and even what I want to talk about, we'll take a quick break here, but the idea that some restaurants, trendy or untrendy, they've gone away from reservations. They feel like this is the bane of their existence, and they can't figure it out. So they say first come, first serve. We see it with Au Cheval in the West Loop, which is a 3-hour wait to get in there, but they don't, and they're pretty strict. You can't walk in there and even cloud up. I've tried.
I don't know. I'll tell you about my experience during Burger Month.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
You're able. They're like, oh, the Tribune's got some clout.
No way.
But my point being that, like, they're a restaurant that just said, you know what, like, we're just not dealing with it across the board. So there are options. We'll continue the conversation. 312-981-7200. Keep your thoughts coming. Call and text, and we will continue with Louisa Chu here, Chicago Tribune food reporter, and her podcast, Chewing, that she does with Monica Eng, which can be found at Chicago Tribune. Stay with us. All right. We'll continue the conversation of charging people if they don't show up to reservations.
What?
Hey, there it is. See, Martyr's on my side.
Absolutely not. It's ridiculous.
This is the conversation. Like, there are some small businesses, boutique kind of restaurants, that are looking to charge people $20-$25 if you blow off a reservation. Like, if you don't call in advance, like a dentist office, like a doctor's appointment.
It was like Ted Knight standing there from Caddyshack?
Exactly.
Well, we're waiting. Come on. Give me a break.
You said you didn't show up. All right. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Louisa Chu, half of the Chewing podcast. You guys are on. I would say that you and Monica are on. We call you regulars.
I hope so. Yeah.
All right, good. I wanted
yeah.
to make sure that
oh my
was
gosh.
Legit.
No.
Regular contributors here to the download. Luis, of course, a food reporter for the Chicago Tribune. You can find Chewing Podcast, the newest one, at the Chicago Tribune website. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm interested. Let's talk about that real quick. The South Side episode. Why the South Side episode? Why an episode of Chewing on the South Side?
You know, I ended up finding some really great food, basically, on the South Side. You know, we recently had Burger Month, and Monica had done a story where she was trying to find Chicago-made food. And they seem to be, like, so unknown in Chicago. There's, like, this... I'm sure you know, there's like this invisible like curtain on areas that are the South Side, actually not even South, like maybe just like West Side. And people like never go there, like the Big Baby cheeseburger, double cheeseburger. So we're doing this, you know, whole month of cheeseburgers. And I was like, why is there not a Chicago style cheeseburger? And
yeah, right.
Half of the city says, yeah, there is. It's called the Big Baby. And so I just thought it was so funny. And, you know, so one of my friends, Dr. Peter Engler, who is a research scientist who studied this, actually. I mean, actually, his work was in genetics, but he studied the burger for like 15 years. And he's like, yeah, no, everybody, especially like around Midway Airport, totally knows about it. So I think it's kind of a symbol, actually.
Isn't that interesting, regionally, when we think about delicacies or just, you know, types of food, mm-hmm. where even in the city of Chicago, there can be pockets that are like, I know this food in and out. You know what I think about is in Springfield has the horseshoe sandwich.
Yes.
And that's something that only up till maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And then they said, it's a horseshoe. And I ordered it at some bar and I was like, this is, oh my God, what am I doing?
Right.
This is crazy.
I can understand maybe like geography sort of saying like Springfield's a little bit farther, but the South Side, I mean, basically the elephant in the room is that a lot of people from the North Side don't think of going down to the South Side, which isn't even that far, because of a lot of stereotypes about the South Side.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So this is kind of, you know, this is something that we're all familiar with, this Big Baby double cheeseburger. So I wrote about that. And then Monica actually also then hit a lot of the like the classic South Side specialties too with a couple of her friends, including one of ours, Natalie Moore, who wrote the book The South Side.
Right. She was on the program.
And so, you know, I just think it's fascinating that we even have that segregation when it comes to food, when it comes to a cheeseburger. So we talk about that.
What a travesty.
It is.
Cheeseburger segregation.
Exactly. But it's got a fascinating history, and talk about that. And I went to visit one of the best places that makes it, Nikki's Hot Dogs at the corner of Archer and Austin. Makes a classic historic Big Baby double cheeseburger.
I'm into it, man. I love the double cheeseburger here in Chicago. So the Big Baby. Big Baby.
That's
all right. 815 says, I suggest that restaurants only commit 80% of their seating space for reservations. We talked about that. 773 says, a competitor could make reservations, then be a no-show. Yes, it charged 20 for reservations for 4 more people. 20 per reservation, not per person. I don't know. That's like espionage.
You know, actually, like, you know what? I think that you're... Now that I remember the details, I think that that is right. I think the qualification was 20
per person.
No, per reservation.
Reservation.
Which is nothing.
It's still something.
Well, relatively, you're right. It's still something.
312 says, as far as a contract, it's a matter of the level of ethical responsibility. Running a restaurant's an orchestrated art.
Yeah.
So I think they're with, making a reservation is a contract. Look it up. It's not a strong one, but it's an agreement that the restaurant will hold a table for you. Your honor of said contract is to fill that seat. then he insults me.
Oh.
Take a business course. Classic.
In your spare time.
In my spare time.
Yeah, all your spare time.
Let's go to Debbie. Debbie, what do we like? What's your thought on this?
My thing is, what if it's Mother's Day and or Thanksgiving? You know, it's a really big time, and the restaurants have to have that reservation come in at a certain time.
Yeah.
So they should get billed for that. Or what if they stay, you know, double their reservation?
Right.
So the next table is waiting and waiting. So, you know, my brother has a restaurant, and he says, you know, on the reservation, you agreed that you will leave within 2 hours.
Ooh.
But then, how do you make them leave?
Yeah.
Bouncer,
right?
Yeah, you can't make them leave. You can, like, you know, they won't pay the bill. You don't give them any more coffee. You don't serve them anymore. But they're going to still stay, and it's just so rude.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Thanks, Debbie. You know, and I think that it is a slippery slope. To be honest, I mean, you start to get into those questions, like, okay, as the one person said, I mean, Monica, I think it was, who said it. This idea that, if I'm going to make a contract for a table, what's the, what on the restaurant side is their part of the bargain?
Well, and again, it's not only the restaurant and it's other diners. And, you know, these are conversations that have been had for a very, very long time. And so what some restaurants will do is approach the table. Say I'm sitting there, I lose track of time because I'm catching up with all my cousins or something. And the restaurant come up to you and say, like, hey, we really so appreciate your business. We, you know, we've got another reservation coming in. Can we move you someplace else and like give you another drink or something? You know, I mean, or just take the rest of whatever you're still eating, you know, working on dessert that you haven't touched yet because you're just like laughing away. These are conversations I've had for a long time.
I know. You should do it my style.
Oh, dear.
What I do is when they come up and say, you've been here too long, I reach into my pocket, I pull out cash, and I just throw it at them. I just all my loose bills at them, and I'm like, hey, right. I'm staying here. I own this place now. Very Donald Trumpian of me.
There we go. Yeah.
I've never done that in my life. Right. Can you imagine that?
No.
Pull it out just, here, I'm talking.
Just
I'll eat my cheesecake on my time.
You just prefer a fistful of change, you know, coins, so it rolls away. Like, you know.
606 says a $20 fee is BS. That they would even consider doing this tells me that I would go elsewhere. They're only interested in a dollar.
They are not.
630 says restaurants, people need to start taking responsibility for their actions. Although the reservation you made no longer fits your schedule, the restaurant still needs to they ended up holding up their end of the bargain, so you owe them. Reservations are an agreement. Keeps going on. You tell me you show up for a reservation at a restaurant and they tell you it'll be a 2-hour wait. You get upset. It's fairness, and I'm for restaurants charging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. That's from Vic from Wooddale.
Yeah.
I'm you know, I go back and forth, and I was feeling one way, and I'm letting the listeners kind of sway me one way or the other.
You're just like, you know, carried along like a little wave.
Why not?
You know? Well,
smart people. They tell me what the
they
what's
are.
Up.
I might put out there again just to have the conversations, you know, and like a possible solution. I said I might offer a possible solution.
Okay, what's that solution?
You know, and again, even though Chicago restaurant culture. Basically, we don't normally charge, but we've come to a point in our lives, in our history, social culture, where it's like we can say, hey, okay, we kind of like we're used to paying everything for hotels and airlines and things like that. We basically say one more step. If you don't show up after 15 minutes, you know, you get a grace period, we're going to have to assume that you're not going to show up. And we will give you a credit to the restaurant, and then your table will be released.
Oh, okay.
After that.
What's the credit? Like $20 credit?
Exactly.
So next time you get $20 off.
Exactly. Right? Because we really do want you to come
in. So it forces you to come back.
It doesn't force you. It invites. Right. It's an invitation, Justin. There's no forcing.
I feel like it might be time to get rid of reservations entirely. We talked about this before the break. What is the holdup on that?
Well, it is because they're, you know, as we were saying, Chicago's become a very competitive restaurant culture. And so it is small businesses. And so the restaurant food that you're getting in certain places is not like you're just going to throw another cheeseburger, you know, on the grill. It's a little more complex. You put a lot of investment into preparing for those dinners. I mean, and it's, you know, like we were saying, there are restaurants like, say, Au Cheval in the West Loop where you can't make a reservation. You might have to wait 3 hours or like me, you get lucky and get a 5-minute
table. Well, here it comes.
No, it was lucky. No favoritism whatsoever. I just got lucky and I was very willing to wait. But that's a whole different situation. They don't have necessarily the same kind of intense prep that goes into a slightly, even though it's casual, a slightly finer dining restaurant.
I just wonder. I mean, I'm not a big fan of taking a system, an antiquated system in my mind, and then saying, since it's broken, we will also charge you on top of it. I just feel at a certain point I would rather the restaurant gods among us get together for the restaurant constitutional convention. And they come up with a new system. I like what Nick Kokonis is at least trying the ticketed system, but they do something that says, you know what, let's upgrade this because this is an epidemic, if it is, and people aren't showing up for reservations, so we need to change it.
Well, I don't necessarily think that it's an epidemic. I think in certain kinds of restaurants, it tends to happen a little bit more than others. And again, in a place like Logan Square, where you do have higher rents, but you can, say, open a smaller restaurant the way like Jason didn't. And we're using Jason as an example, even though, you know, there's a lot of other restaurants that are going to do the same thing.
He's an example because he brought it up for the restaurant giant. He's actually getting promotion out of this because we said the restaurant giant
there you
like
go.
12 times.
Yeah, and it's a restaurant I'm looking forward to going to as well. And so, you know.
I'm
going to
cancel my reservation just to see what happens. No, I'm not going to cancel. I'm just going to show up.
Right. There
Jason,
you go.
You heard me.
Exactly.
No, I'm
well, you know,
I'll
you can you could try to cancel within 24 hours and then you'll still
I'm
going to
do it like I do with a doctor. Right. I'm like, you're not going to believe what just happened. It'll be long, like I'll do in the comment section, like with only 8 hours to go and see if I can get out of it.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not going to believe my day.
Yeah, the excuse, yeah. So, but, you know, I don't necessarily think it's an epidemic. There's lots of restaurants that are thriving, and you'll see in that comment thread, too, there are other restaurants, like, say, for example, Big Jones, that still goes by a more, you know, classic system. And it just really depends so much on where you are. And I think that actually the charging is a fix to a solution. It's an evolution, maybe not necessarily a complete fix, but I think that, again, we can evolve and have conversations. Like, whatever happened to, like, picking up the phone or texting or whatever?
Well, I mean,
having
a
conversation.
Is this a byproduct of the way we are communicating, where everything is done online? You can go to OpenTable, you can go to the website, and you're clicking a button, and you're not putting as much social currency into the reservation.
It very well could be. Having said that, sometimes there's like the only time you can think of, like for me, I kind of feel like the only time I have time to do personal stuff, like make a personal reservation, is when places aren't open, you know?
That's
and
true.
So the best time, best way to do that is, you know, online. And that's okay. But it's like if you can't do it, have a conversation. I think that sometimes what's unfortunate, and again, is that, you know, oh, yeah, no, it's terrible. Oh, so you can just not show and then take the food out of young Jason Vincent's daughter's mouth. That's okay, right? Is that right? Is that
I think
okay
the art of the conversation for a reservation has been lost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm a big fan of, like, putting on a character when I call. I do, when they call and they go, Giant, I go, hey, how you doing? listen, what you got for two at 6 o'clock? Like something like that, you know, where you're just real cheer. Hey, listen, I'm looking for something 8 o'clock. What do you got for 3? Can you do 8:30? I'm like, you know what? Let's just split the difference. Let's do 8:15.
Dear.
See, that's that we're missing that.
No,
and
I
know all the hosts in Chicago love it. They're like, oh man, he's so good.
And actually that is one of the big things too, is that a lot of people can't even afford to have people answer the phone for reservations anymore. You know, I mean, you have people like yourself, perhaps, just like spending people's hours and hours.
I do like
years
to, I
of their
do,
lives.
I do give them a whole thing. I'm a big time player. And listen, are you still there?
You want certain music playing when you roll in?
This is a big night for me and my honey.
Right. There
okay.
You go.
If you can when you put the ring in the old sorbet. No. I think this is a great conversation. We should continue it at some point because I do think there's. A lot of people here that are still 7708 says, no, I would not pay a reservation fee. I see his point about the cost and inconvenience as a delivery driver. Occasionally you have to walk through spider web or a bunch of spider webs on the way to someone's front door and you got to do it, you know?
What?
That's his point.
Okay. I delivered as a young child and never walked through spider webs. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But,
well, maybe it's a spider
dramatic.
Webs. But, well, maybe we're just done with the conversation.
No. Scary kitty cats.
All right, Louisa, so the Southside episode is up.
Yes.
And you can find it at the Tribune's website.
ChicagoTribune.com.
What's the next
dining?
One?
We're going to be on hiatus for the month of August, but we're going to be putting out possibly some specials because we have, right now, we're in the height of farmer's market season now. And so I brought you a delicious surprise.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, this is the famed segment of your podcast, which is Will She Eat It?
Yeah. It's a little game that my co-host Monica Eng and I like to play called Will She Eat It?
Right.
So usually it's, you know, thematic related, not always. And she usually tries to bring me something that will, I think, significantly poison me.
I saw somewhere the last time she brought a gas station hot dog.
Yeah.
From
that was from
Texas.
The South Side episode. Yes.
Was it?
Yes. And it was, I don't even think it qualified, quite frankly, Justin, because it was like she brought it from Mississippi.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I mean, come on. That's not a South Side specialty, okay?
I guess it's South.
Yeah.
I don't know about South Side.
Please.
All right. And then you brought in the egg, the weird egg, the 200 or 100 year old egg last time. That was gross.
Actually, early in this season, it was for our egg episode. It was one of the Chinese 1,000 year old eggs. Not really a 1,000 year old egg, but it looked like a Game of Thrones egg, you know, with clear green outside, and the inside was black and sludgy. Mm-hmm. But that tasted okay.
It was all right.
It just tasted really bad.
It looked bad.
It did. I'll admit that.
You get thrown off by the years.
Exactly.
All right, what do you got tonight?
I got something that looks bad too. So I posted this actually. We posted this on our Tribune food and dining page. So for Farmers Market Month, I am doing all sorts of stories about corn coming up, like Sheffy corn. And so one of the things I actually found at the local Cermak Fresh Market by my store, by my house, is wheat locoche. Do you know wheat locoche?
Wheat locoche, no.
Yeah. So it's also known as corn smut. And it is a delicacy in Mexican cuisine.
Okay.
And so what happens is that regular ears of corn, and actually usually this is like organic corn because it only grows on corn that hasn't been treated. This is a new product, a new company called Oro Negro Cuitlacoche. It's grown by a scientist, actually, up outside of Madison. And so you want to describe what this looks like,
So it looks like a piece of corn, like an actual ear of corn.
Mm-hmm. It is.
But it's blackened, and it looks moldy.
Yes, exactly. And so it's actually fungus. And not only that, but some of the kernels, they are like engorged, enlarged. And so this is a delicacy. What's really rare about this is this is actually the only fresh ear of wheat locoche that you can buy locally, commonly now, is found in the Chicagoland market. Hmm. So this is a big deal. It just came out. And this particular ear was picked last week. So I'm going to offer you the corn smut.
All right, let's do it.
Justin.
And we'll put the corn smut up on the Instagram page.
Okay.
WGN Instagram page.
Pass this over to you, Justin.
So what is this? This is it?
Mm-hmm. So that is, man. Oh yeah. So that is what, here, I'll show you the whole ear.
Pete.
So each kernel, they kind of like grossly misshapen and black and fuzzy. Like, seriously, you don't. I was thinking.
Don't eat it. Did you just say don't eat it?
No. I said no. I'm going to offer it. I'm going to offer it to you, Justin.
All right.
Will you eat it?
Yes, I'm going to eat it.
All right.
So do I just eat the whole thing?
You can eat it the whole thing. You can eat it raw.
Live.
For
salad.
You
can eat it raw?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can eat it raw.
I'm just making sure I'm not missing the rules. I'm running a radio show. I don't want to be like, don't eat that.
No.
And then, I get sick for the next hour.
Yes, you can eat it raw safely. It's also cooked. So Justin is going to eat the fresh cuitlacoche.
Cuitlacoche.
Crispy, crunchy. I can hear that crunch. What's that flavor like there?
It's dirty corn. It's like dirty fresh corn.
Dirty fresh corn.
But it's like salad. It feels like it's a little bit lettucey, like moldy lettuce.
Okay.
But in a good way, like it's crunchy.
Okay. Do you get any mushroomy notes, kind of truffly notes in there?
Yeah,
maybe?
Like that's the dirty.
Okay. All right.
Earthy.
Yeah, earthy.
That's
Thank
what I'm thinking.
You.
Earthy is
go.
The earthy is what I'm thinking.
That
about.
Is exactly what I was thinking.
It's not
at
bad.
First too. Yeah,
it's not bad at all. I mean, I don't know what you would eat it for.
Because when it's cooked, it brings out a whole other kind of mushroomy or truffly flavor.
Right.
So apparently, Rick Bayless might be carrying this or cooking this in some of his restaurants because it is a rare delicacy. And so, Justin, you get one of the very first local taste of the Oro Negro Cuitlacoche.
Cuitlacoche, I'll take it. All right, it's good. Luisa Chu from Chicago Tribune, food reporter, of course. Chewing, the podcast you can find at chicagotribune.com/dining. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Looking forward to the next podcast that comes out with you and Monica Ang.
Thanks, Justin.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. Coming up, Jack Silverstein's going to join us. We're going to talk about the 10-year anniversary of the 06-07 Chicago Bears, a team that went to the Super Bowl and lost. You know, we're just, I think I've lost a little bit of excitement for this just based on Pete's observation that, you know, we're upon these 10-year anniversaries of those Cubs teams that got swept in the first round of games against the Dodgers. And remember that team where you had, oh, this is going to be it. Carlos Zambrano.
The Big Z.
Big Z, this is our year. Go, Cubs, go. Oh, it's over.
Yeah, the Big Z's jock strap was on a little too tight, I think. he was wound. He was a tightly wound individual.
I like that, man. I wish where's he at? He needs to come back to Chicago.
He'll be in the next Sports Illustrated Where Are They Now
edition. They should have him come back and be, you know, like he would be with the team in one of the Olympic countries. To be like, it's Finland, and look who's there. It's Carlos Zambrano from the Chicago Cubs. A little song for you to get your hopes up. The 2016 Chicago Bears. But let's look back in time. 10 years ago, the Chicago Bears were getting ready to defend their... They won the NFC North the year before. Lost in the playoffs to the Carolina Panthers the year before the 2006 season. So hopes were riding high. And the team did not disappoint. Although, as you know... Pete Zimmerman kind of ruined our he kind of put the pin to the balloon, Jack, because he's like, well, he kind of reminded us that the Cubs also are celebrating 10 years from being in the playoffs. Jack Silverstein of the Windy City Gridiron, who's this fall is writing an ongoing series of retrospectives on the 2006 Bears, joins me now. Jack, how are you, my man?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. So why should we be celebrating a team 10 years ago that made the Super Bowl but lost?
So it's funny. I was listening for the last 15 minutes, and I heard you say that you were kind of – you originally were excited about this segment, and then you were reminded that, wait a second, they lost.
Right.
And why are we celebrating all these losing teams? So in 2013, I did some stories on the 10-year anniversary of the 2003 Cubs and the Bartman game and all that. And I interviewed some players, and one of the players I interviewed was Paul Bacco, who was the catcher in the Bartman.
Yeah, right.
He was awesome. We talked for probably an hour. And at the end of it, he said, listen, have you heard, like, are there going to be any kind of, like, celebrations for us? Are they going to have us out and honor us or anything like that? And I was like, I don't know what to tell you, bro. Like, people are still pretty upset about that. Like, I don't think so. Like,
right.
Maybe, but no, probably not. Sorry. And he was just kind of like, oh, okay. So I totally understand that we're not going to, you know, sing a song and raise a flag and have a big ceremony for this team that lost. The reason that I like to celebrate these teams, and specifically this 06 Bears team, is because we watch a sports team, whether they win or they lose. And we generally, I mean, unless you're like freakish like me and you rewatch old games all the time, you generally only watch a team and a team season and a game once. Mm-hmm. But these games and these seasons, they're also like great movies. So imagine if you went to the movies and you saw a great movie and you never watched it again. And you went to the movies and you saw a terrible movie and you never watched it again. It doesn't make any sense. So to me, I like to celebrate these teams and look back on them because beyond just the did they win or did they not win, week in and week out, you were watching the Bears and they were – awesome.
They really were, man. They were. And it's great to look back on that team. One of my favorite football teams of all time. Let's get into it. I mean, you're doing the retrospectives on the team. You know, what I read today was really interesting about the sort of offseason and the acquisitions and draft picks from the successful season, which saw the return of Rex Grossman, but a first, I guess it would be a second round loss to the Carolina Panthers. At Soldier Field, that was a joke.
Right.
To what they did in the summer to get to the Super Bowl. So let's start there. What were the Bears looking at this time of year in 2006?
Well, they considered themselves to be a team with 22 starters returning. And that actually means that you think that Justin Gage was going to be the starting receiver opposite Mousin Muhammad. But they still had Bernard Berrien. He ended up being the starter. But regardless, they went into the draft with 22 starters. And they knew that they needed to do a few things. One, they needed to have a better backup quarterback. They needed a better contingency plan for Rex, who had missed time in his first three seasons in the NFL.
Yeah, and didn't that year that the Kyle Orton played the year, that was his rookie season that he had to be forced into action, wasn't it, the year before? And then Rex Grossman came back at the end of that season.
Yes. Right. So Rex got hurt in the preseason, and Orton, as a fourth-round rookie, was the week one starter. And he started all the way through to the Atlanta game, which was in December's frigid game at Soldier Field.
And Michael Vick didn't play, right?
Yeah. And Orton didn't play well in the first half. And the guillotine was kind of already, you know, over his head at that point. And they brought Rex out in the second half. Everybody at Soldier Field went crazy. And he then started the next week, the Christmas game against Green Bay, and won. And then they did something kind of makes sense if he'd been healthy all the whole year, but doesn't really at all make sense in his situation, which is that they rested him in that final game against Minnesota when we'd already won the division. And we got tossed against Minnesota, and then we had the bye week, and then Rex came out against Carolina.
Flat.
And it flat. So they knew that they needed a backup, and they signed Brian Griese from Tampa Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, Brian Griese, the article that you were talking about that I wrote for Windy City Gridiron was the five most important additions for that team. And I put Brian Griese number two, because Brian Griese, having him back there, even though he never started the game, it turned the fire up under Rex.
Right.
It gave them a legitimate backup quarterback who could step in and lead a team, as he did well the following year in 2007. And so they signed Rex. They signed Ricky Manning Jr., the cornerback from Carolina.
I love that guy. And then he got in the fight in Denny's
on the day he signed. And that was why Carolina didn't match the Bears' offer sheet.
Oh, so it worked out, yeah.
So it worked out, right.
And he was coming off a good season with Carolina. He was a corner for Carolina, and he was considered a nice free agent pickup.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he played great. He had five interceptions, tied for the team lead with Peanut Thielman. He had a pick six. Two of his interceptions were in this, like, class of the NFC game, the week four game against Seattle, mm-hmm. nationally televised game, where we just stopped them 37-6. So, yeah, Manning, he was great. And we went into the draft, had the 26th pick, and traded down. And took in the second round Danielle Manning, who like no one had heard of, the safety from Abilene Christian,
yep.
and Devin Hester, who everyone said had no position.
They thought it was a reach
They thought it was a reach. They thought, why are you picking this return man at 57 in the second round? And what's wild is that, you know, I got back into the microfilm and I was looking at the reporting of the day. And they pegged Devin Hester not just for his return skills, but because, quote, Steve Smith burned us in the playoffs last year and we need cornerback help. I mean, can you imagine a world in which we thought Devin Hester was going to help us defend Steve
Smith? He played corner towards the end of – or in middle or end of that year. He ended up playing a couple of times in corner. He did not last very long. The games in nickel situations. He was not good.
In his big coming out game against the Rams, he returned the two kicks for touchdowns. He was also posted up by Torrey Holt on a 6-yard fade. I mean, can you imagine Devin Hester defending possibly a Hall of Fame wide receiver?
That's great.
One on one on the outside on a fade route and the goal. I mean, wild.
Jack Silverstein's with Windy City Gridiron. This fall, he's writing an ongoing series of retrospectives on the 2006 Bears. Let me take a quick break so I can stay on time here. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us.
Stand up and holler. Two bears, four bears, $6 a dollar. $6 a dollar. If you're a Bears fan like me, stand up and holler. Stand up and holler.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. Jack Silverstein joins me from Windy City Gridiron. This fall, right, an ongoing series of retrospectives on the 2006 Bears. Jack, we talked about the five things that made changes in that offseason. We talked about Ricky Manning, Brian Griese, the draft of Devin Hester, of course. What were the other ones?
The fifth one, so let's see, Hester, Griese, Ricky Manning, Danielle Manning. The fifth one was fifth round draft pick Mark Anderson, a defensive end out of Alabama.
And he was a force for a little bit there.
Yeah, he had 12 sacks. He was eighth in the NFL in sacks. He was this situational edge rusher. His biggest play was he sacked Matt Leinart in the third quarter of the famous Cardinals comeback game, and that started the comeback. He sacked Leinart, forced a fumble, ball bounced away, Mike Brown scooped it up,
good,
and that was the first touchdown. And I tweeted that to Mark Anderson, and I said, yo, man, were you, like, surprised to have that much space? And he wrote, they messed up the protection, and I had to capitalize. And then he tweeted an emoji of a fork and a knife. He was eating good.
He's eating good. All right, so let's back it up. I mean, were the expectations for this team in 2006, once we got the offseason settled in camp, preseason, were the expectations that this team was going to repeat in the division and maybe go further?
Yes, 100%. And I don't know. The big question mark, of course, was Grossman. And obviously, when your quarterback's a question mark, that's like eight question marks if, you know, any other position. But that aside, we had the best defense in the NFL. We had this wonderful running game. We had these five great offensive linemen up front. We had Thomas Jones, Jason McKee blocking for him. And we had this special teams unit that had been doing well even before Hester's arrival, because Jerry Azuma was a Pro Bowl return man.
Right.
So the expectations were absolutely come out.
And he retired, didn't he? Azuma retired in the offseason.
He had that neck injury, and he was number 23, and then Hester was number 23.
Right.
I remember that first game, though, against Green Bay, in Green Bay, being concerned. And I still wasn't totally sure, even though the Packers were coming off this terrible year.
And the Packers had such a tremendous, track record against the Bears. Brett Favre was quarterback. You just had this feeling it wasn't going to go well going into Green Bay, but it worked out, man.
Fifth play of that game, we went play action, and the two biggest pieces of the offense who weren't really a factor the year before hooked up. Rex went play action, went deep to Bernard Berrien. It was one of like five or six 40-yard touchdowns that they hooked up for, and that's when you felt like, okay, we have this extra dimension now, and maybe things are going to be okay. We put up a few field goals, and then Devin had his welcome to the NFL moment.
Yeah.
When he returned a punt 84 yards for his first NFL touchdown, we blanked Green Bay. It was the first time that Brett Favre had ever been shut out in his career, 26-0. And that's when I started to feel like,
such a great game.
This is headed in the right direction.
Peanut came off the edge. I remember that. And he clocked Brett Favre. That was a moment. Like, they just had everything going the way they that was such a great game. And what happened in the next games up, I mean, you mentioned that connection between Rex Grossman and Bernard Berrien. They figured out, or they put into the playbook, finally a fly route, and they let Bernard Berrien just run down the sideline. And I don't know if teams in the defensive schemes didn't think that the Bears could do that, that Rex Grossman didn't have the arm strength, but it seemed like games against Buffalo, games against Seattle, games against San Francisco, they just went single coverage and let them go, and the Bears made them pay.
Rex Grossman was leading the NFL in passer rating for like the first 5 weeks of the season. I mean, that Arizona game, we kind of think of that as like, that's bad Rex, and that was what he did that season. But that stood out because he'd been so great early in the year. I mean, he had six turnovers against Arizona, and that was just not at all the guy who'd been playing early in the season. So he was racking up touchdowns. He had four in week two against Detroit. And then he had the game-winning touchdown to Rasheed Davis in Minnesota.
Right.
Yeah. So Rex was really on it. And once you knew that, all right, to quote Lovey, Rex is our quarterback, once you knew that that was the case, I think everybody kind of felt like, all right, this is our team. This is our year. and there's really nobody in the NFC who can touch us.
I'm loving this conversation. Let's take a break so I can get to the news on time. When we come back, let's talk about the where you started to see cracks in the foundation. A lot of it had to do with injuries, and people forget about some of the injuries that this team had before they even got to the playoffs. You know, and the distractions on the field. I mean, Tommy Harris went out. Tank Johnson had this strange off the field altercations that, and not to mention, and there were a lot of other stuff involved too. But a tremendous start to the season that ended up sort of, you know, having some signs, some telltale signs about the doom and gloom that might happen to this team. 10 years ago, we're talking about the anniversary of the 2006 Chicago Bears, who went to the Super Bowl and lost to the Colts. Jack Silverstein is with Windy City Gridiron. This fall, he's writing an ongoing series of retrospectives about the team. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with us.
Kane is in the building.
Petra on fire tonight. Some ballers for us. Speaking of the original baller team, the Chicago Bears. 2006, we're celebrating their 10-year anniversary. Jack Silverstein of Windy City Gridiron, who's regular here on the show, is doing this whole fall. He's writing an ongoing series of retrospectives on the team. We're kind of talking about that in full tonight. You know, Jack, it's interesting because I am I think of that team and I think about when they lost that game to Miami. They were undefeated. Miami came in and beat them. And then we started to see a blueprint on how to actually beat the Bears and Rex Grossman.
So I was actually at that game.
Oh.
And we were 7-0. And so to go to the one game where you lose, and you lose bad, 31-13 to Joey Harrington and his second team, yeah, that was ugly. Yeah. But I didn't really get concerned, actually, until the Tampa Bay game. And there were two reasons. One, you mentioned injuries. I would say that there were three players on the defense who you felt like you can't lose these three guys. One was Tommy Harris, one was Brian Urlacher, and one was Mike Brown. And we lost two of the three. Mm-hmm. Mike Brown got hurt. You know, we talked about his touchdown against the Cardinals. Well, later in that game,
right,
he went out for the year. Broke his foot.
Was that he came, did he play again after that? He played again, no, and got hurt, or was that it?
No, that was it.
For his career?
No. So then the next year in the opening game against, right, San Diego,
right, that's,
he got injured and was out for the year. In 2008, he played almost the whole season. I think he played 15 games. And then in 2009, he had 1 year with the Chiefs and then he retired.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, I digress. Keep going.
Tommy Harris against Minnesota, he got injured.
Yeah.
And he was out for the rest of the year. And that was where they had done this sort of shuffle at D tackle. Originally, it was Tommy Harris and Ian Scott. And then Tank Johnson stepped in for Ian Scott. And then Ian Scott stepped in for the injured Tommy Harris. But Tommy Harris was
a monster. I mean, let's talk about Tommy Harris, who ended up making the Pro Bowl that year, even though he got hurt and was out,
right,
for the year. He had,
right,
such a tremendous beginning to the season, kind of defensive tackle we hadn't seen in Chicago since, you know, Dan Hampton and Steve McMichael. He was, yeah, disruptive. He was getting to the quarterback. He had speed. He really was. When you think about Brian Urlacher and Lance Briggs and all the guys that had great careers here, Tommy Harris in 2006 was really the glue of that defense.
He was brilliant. And he was drafted in 04. He was good in 04. And then he was a Pro Bowler 05, 06, 07. And then kind of, you know, was whatever in 08, 09, and then had a little bit of a comeback season in 10, went to San Diego, and he retired. He was brilliant. He was brilliant. They couldn't, you couldn't block him. And I know that, you know, the NFL is putting up three games on YouTube for every franchise, and one of the three for the Bears is, of course, the Cardinals game. Of course, everybody wants to watch that. Man, the game that I would have wanted to rewatch,
Seattle,
was that Seattle game.
Yeah, he was great in that game.
Remember those announcers just being floored by Tommy Harris's speed.
He was making Mac. It was Matt Hasselbeck, right? It was a quarterback,
yeah,
and they mm-hmm. had coming off. They were in the Super Bowl the year before,
right?
And they came into that game, and Tommy Harris just was destroying the offensive line of Seattle.
He just he deconstructed them. It was awe-inspiring.
So keep going.
Oh, yeah. So the game that where I first was like, okay, now this might be a problem, was this Tampa Bay game. And the Tampa Bay game was, we were 11-2. We were at home. Tampa Bay was 3-10. We had clinched the division 2 weeks before against Minnesota. The week before was the Rams game. And the Rams game against Minnesota, Rex had a 1.3 quarterback rating.
We started
and
to see
going
that,
into
yeah.
that. Yeah, going into that Rams game, the Rams game was like, all right, you've had some real bad games. You've had some real good games. You got to put it together a few in a row here because we might have to give this ball to Greasy. And Rex came out as sort of like an ultimatum game. And he came out and he was great against the Rams. But on the other hand, it's designed for him to be great. It's indoors. It's on turf. You know, no conditions.
Right.
So then we go and we play Tampa Bay. And we start putting the business on Tampa Bay. And we're up 31-17 in the fourth. And Tampa scored two touchdowns. And they tied the game and they sent it to OT. So now we're in overtime. We've clinched the division. And what I really wanted to see and what we didn't see and what really bothered me at the time, and I don't know if this ended up being the reason we didn't win, but I wanted to see them give Rex the ball and say, we're going to win or lose on your arm and on your ability to lead the team. And we're going to give you this shot because seeing if you can lead us all the way down and score in a pressure situation
is
more important than seeing if we can get a Pro Bowl kicker in the field goal range.
Right.
So we went down and Robbie actually missed his first kick. And it was shocking because he'd been so brilliant all year and was brilliant all year. And so I was just saying like, no, we just got to let it ride with Rex. And we get the ball back and we're still going for this field goal. And he had that great pass to Rashid Davis in overtime, but we still set up for that field goal. And I felt at the time, and I still feel now, that that was a missed opportunity for a young quarterback who hadn't played much before this season. He'd only played 3, 6, 7.5 regular season games coming into 2006. I thought that that was a miss. The other miss was in the season finale against Green Bay, at the game I was at.
That was terrible.
It's the only Bears game I've ever left early.
Yeah.
Because it got flexed up to the night game on New Year's.
Right. And the Bears didn't care.
And they didn't care. They came out flat. And again, that was another thing. I remember listening to the score, and this was in 05. And this woman called in, and she just made such a great point that I always remember. It was when the Bears were going to rest starters against Minnesota. And she said, you don't get better by not playing.
Right.
And I understand wanting to protect your players.
Rex Grossman was very fragile.
And Rex Grossman was very candid that they were not taking that game seriously. Now, I don't think necessarily that those are the reasons that we didn't win. I think that we didn't beat Indianapolis because they had a freakish postseason defensive performance. And weirdly, this Dome team came out in the first ever poor weather Super Bowl and hit the quote unquote, you know, all weather Bears weather team in the mouth and beat us at our own game. And there was some poor coaching in that game because you've got a quarterback with small hands and a wet ball and everybody's fumbling and you keep putting it in his hands to throw and throw and throw. So I really chalk that up more so to the coaching staff and to the injuries to Mike Brown and Tommy Harris. But if there were two games that I pointed to and went, okay, this is now starting to be a problem. It was the Tampa Bay game, and it was the season finale against Green Bay.
For this team, let's talk about off the field. I mean, they had characters on this team. Obviously, Brian Urlacher was Defensive Player of the Year. They had interesting defensive linemen with Tank Johnson.
Brian was actually Defensive Player of the Year before.
Yeah, but, I mean, they had, like, he was a national starter a national name. He was doing Chunky Soup commercials with Devin Hester and that kind of stuff. But it really was Tank and even, I would say, Cedric Benson that became almost sideshows for the Chicago Bears in this way that they became almost negative storylines.
Well, Tank was the real
problem
because he had to get a judge to give him permission to leave the state to play in the Super Bowl because he'd been arrested on those gun charges. And Tank Johnson just ultimately wasn't good enough to warrant, pardon the pun, that kind of excuse of behavior.
Right.
We would have been better off with Ian Scott and whomever. I mean, sliding Alex Brown inside or Wally inside, putting Mark Anderson outside, it just wasn't worth it. And Benson, I mean, you know, Benson is one of these great Chicago Bears busts, but let's not be revisionist. Cedric Benson was becoming a star at the back half of 2006.
Well, I mean,
the book on the Bears was that we had these two running backs.
You mentioned that Tampa Bay game, Jack. Game, that was a game that Cedric Benson starred in. That was where he came out of his shell and he started hitting people, and it was in November, December, and you just got this feeling that as Thomas Jones, you know, the wear and tear of the season went on, here came this rookie who was getting stronger and stronger. And he ran well in the playoffs, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when he got hit by Bob Sanders in the Super Bowl and he fumbled and got injured, I mean, that's ultimately what people remember, is like Cedric Benson was drafted number 4 and he held out his rookie year, and then they traded Thomas Jones to give him the starting spot and he screwed it up, and then they had to release him and he got arrested and blah, 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 blah. And so it becomes this one sort of flowing story from start to finish that Cedric Benson was bad.
Right.
Benson got the ball in the Super Bowl because he wasn't bad, because he was playing great. And, you know, you talk about one game defining a guy's career, one play, one moment, one little, one little shimmy where you shake left and somebody goes right and instead they go left too. And Bob Sanders put the wood on Cedric Benson. That ball went flying and he was done. And it was too bad.
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, it's, from a national standpoint, you know, here in Chicago, you and I will be boosters for that Bears team forever.
Yeah.
Because that defense was, I mean, it was really something special to watch those guys. And Devin Hester, too, and what he did. I mean, it did it. Everything that Lovie Smith promised the Bears were going to be, they were with this team.
Yep.
And Brian Urlacher was doing acrobats. He was an acrobatic lineman, and they were ball hawking, and they were getting to everywhere. It was just phenomenal Bears defense. But the national rep on this Chicago Bears team, and if you talk to people outside, is that the offense was soft, Rex Grossman was bad, and the Bears only got where they got because the defense put the whole team on their shoulders.
Well, I would say it was the special teams as well. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote about breaking down Charles Tillman's Hall of Fame possibilities and the 5 reasons why if he doesn't get in, this is what's going to stop him because of these Hall of Fame biases. And one is a bias against special teams. And the Bears had Charles Tillman blocking on returns and blocking punts. They had, think about the blocks that we made on the field goal return that Devin Hester against the Giants when he, you know, when he ran back the field goal. That's Hillenmeyer out there, Tillman, Brian Urlacher. When Nate Basher the year before against San Francisco returned a field goal for a touchdown, all those guys were out there blocking. Chris Harris. We had one of Devin's kick returns against St. Louis was preventing an onside kick. And so we had the hands team out there, Barry and John Gilmore and Dez Clark, and those guys opened holes. I mean, special teams and defense were a way of life. Do you remember that terrible play in the 2013 finale against Green Bay where we sacked Aaron Rodgers and the ball squirted out and everyone was just standing around, and then the Packers player Boykin picked the ball up and ran into the end zone. And it was amazing. All of these Lovey Bears, all these ex-Lovey guys started tweeting and saying, say whatever you want. It would never happen. I remember Mike Brown tweeted, pick up the rock. He said, Lovey taught us the ball is the game. And on that first touchdown against Arizona, where Mark Anderson sack stripped Liner,
there's Mike 9 Brown guys.
There are 5 guys.
Right.
Mike Brown, ready.
That was the story of that Lovie Smith defense. They just, every guy was around the ball every time it was on the ground, and it was on the ground a lot.
It was on the ground a lot.
Yeah.
And you talk about 3 phases of the game, but then if you
are brilliant in two phases and only pedestrian in one of them. And if that one is offense, then people say you're soft.
Yeah.
It's asinine. 66% of that team was brilliant and 33% of it was good.
Well, it's a testament to how good the special teams and defense was. I mean, really, right? At the point, like just sort of mind-boggling. Jack Silverstein is with Windy City Gridiron. This fall, he's writing an ongoing series of retrospectives on the 2006 Bears and the 10-year anniversary. We're going to have some players on this fall. We'd love to collaborate with you. We'll put it all together. Jack, good to talk to you, and we'll talk again about this very, very important subject of the 2006
great.
Bears.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Thanks a bunch, Pete. I appreciate you guys.
Cubs beating up on the Oakland A's out west, 7-0. John Lester throwing heat. Also, the return of Jorge Soler. The Olympic ceremony, the opening ceremony is over. I swear that was the longest thing. I thought it was over, and I kept looking over, and there'd be another country coming out. But, you know, as a show that's on during a lot of the primetime stuff, or, you know, and I don't think they'll do what they did in China where they had a lot of trouble. I think it was Sochi, too, where they were, because of the time zone problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it was in Beijing, they would have to they'd show us the stuff after we already know who won.
Yeah.
So Michael Phelps would win, and you'd be like, yay! And then they'd show it 3 hours after everybody else on the internet knew it.
Right.
That's not going to be a problem this year.
No.
It's only a two-hour difference, right?
Right. So I know there's been a little bit of a hubbub over NBC deciding to tape delay the opening ceremonies. I think they're an hour off. But
is
I think
still going?
I think for the most part, it's going to be mostly live.
Oh, I thought it was over. There's a guy up on a podium already talking. I guess it is over. It's over in real time, but they're showing the delay.
That's Thomas Bach.
Like the IO.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah. You know, you came up with a great idea to fan jam the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do that for Cubs games. We've done a little bit for Bears games, but the idea of rotation of people to tell us what we missed because we couldn't watch it because we're doing the show, that was highly entertaining. We should do that for the Olympics. That's a great August thing to do, right?
Love it.
I don't know. We'll figure it out. I mean, maybe we could do something at 9 o'clock hour. The 10 o'clock's got, you know, we can't really interrupt Frying Pan, which was not on tonight. Steve Gadlin was in the air. We weren't able to do that. He'll be back next Friday. But, yeah, it feels like that would be good, right? To sort of, what are we missing? How tight are these tight Speedos? Did you see the Canadian swimmer who flips off his dad? Like, uses the middle finger, flips off his dad before he swims? Like, as a term of endearment?
Oh, no, I haven't.
Yeah, it's like a thing where they're like, it's like this weird kind of jockey thing that they do.
I thought when he said the swimmer that flips off his dad, I thought he uses his dad to propel off. That's what I thought you meant. Like he's flipping off his dad. It took me a while to understand what you meant there. I was like, wait, he's jumping off his dad?
He uses his dad. His dad, yeah. You can have one family member in the water. No, he has some weird kind of thing where he like flips the bird to his dad before he gets up on the podium.
Well, that's the stuff I want to know about. That's the story
right.
behind the. I want to know what's
that's
going
the stuff
on with the
that
broadcast.
We would, yeah, the fan jam. Yeah. Right. We would definitely need to do that, right?
Can't wait.
That would be good. That would be fun.
When I was watching the Olympic opening ceremonies, I have this. We had no sound on, and I have the subtitles going, and every time it says, speaking in Portuguese, cheering and clapping.
That's all it says on the
like, oh.
That's essentially what happened tonight. That's the Olympics. Speaking in Portuguese,
cheering and clapping.
That should be the tagline for the 2016 Olympics. Speaking in Portuguese, cheering and clapping. When do they start this stuff? Is it now on? Like tomorrow, are we going to get Michael Phelps for like primetime, that kind of thing?
I'm not sure. I know it starts. The competition starts. I'm not sure when the swimming and the gymnastics.
They usually do like swimming stuff first, right? Because I always felt like gymnastics is towards the end, like because you always get like the Gabby Douglas kind of stuff was towards the end of the Olympics. I remember that, like the Ryan Lochte
yeah.
and Michael Phelps stuff was early. Like that's like the first sense. I think swimming's right out. No pun intended. Right off the gun.
We were running a commercial that featured Ryan Lochte, and I was like, boy, I miss that guy. Kind of a dummy, you know. You'd see him on the soup all the time.
Yeah, see, this would be for Fan Jam, but I guess he dyed his hair blue for the Olympics. I don't know if he's even swimming. I think he's just like now he's
hanging out.
He's just hanging
being
out.
Ryan Lochte.
It's what you do.
Yeah,
but it doesn't look blue. It looks gray.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that what that means. You know, it's now cool to dye your hair gray.
It is.
Because he's probably 24.
Yeah.
You know, it's like because you grow up with these guys, you're like, oh, he must be 40 now because we've had him for a couple. But, you know, yeah. they swim when they're 16.
Yeah,
17.
Right.
I don't know. But so I'm looking forward to the Olympics. This weekend, I'm going to try. I'm going to try with my son. I'm going to be like, we're watching the prelims.
Hope there's something good.
Right, exactly. I mean, maybe we get some beach volleyball in.
No, you're a fan of that.
And I'm more indoor.
Oh, that's right. That's
I like
right. Excuse
the indoor.
Me. Yeah.
The indoor kind of. Fake spike where the guy comes up and fakes it and the other guy fakes it and the third guy comes in and knocks it down. I'm like, that's sport. There's trickery. As Will Ferrell playing George Bush. Strategy.
Misdirection.
A lot of that. Tight shorts. Tight shorts.
Is ping pong still a sport in the Olympics?
I don't
know. I always found that to be real enjoyable and somebody recommended badminton. And I wasn't sure if
is
they were...
Is badminton a sport in the Olympics?
I wasn't sure if they were teasing or...
We should play that game. What sport is not an Olympic sport?
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know. Well, all right. Well, anyway, the Olympics, I'll let you know how it goes this weekend because I'm really going to force my kid to watch it. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. We'll be back on Monday. Patty Vasquez up next. Have a great weekend, Rob.
You do the same, my friend. Enjoy the rhythmic gymnastics.
You're going to watch this.